It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster
conquered the street.
I like fighting a woman.
What is with this company's obsession with ninjas?
Oh my God, we're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
God, this dialogue is shit.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and threaten me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Solo Monster, who are you to doubt El Dandy?
Woo!
This is episode 682 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, December 13, 2020. I am the Solo Monster. Happy Hanukkah to those who celebrate. What are we in here? This is night four. I think getting ready for night number four. Kenny Omega had himself a busy week, going from Nashville on Tuesday, even though that was taped days earlier. But let's just play along here. Let's just roll with it. Went from Nashville on Tuesday to Jacksonville on Wednesday, back to Nashville last night for the Impact pay-per-view, and then he had 30 minutes to make it to Mexico and get into his gear for his match at Triple Mania. Omega was back on his bus during the Final Resolution pay-per-view last night, reminiscing with his former Bullet Club buddy, Carl Anderson, teasing a possible Bullet Club reunion. And then later on, Omega retained his AAA Mega title against Laredo Kid at Triple Mania. One winged angel off the middle rope for the win, so Omega keeps the title. And I think he's about to go on a bit of a streak of trying to collect all sorts of hardware from different promotions all over the country, all over the world. Feels like the hottest thing in wrestling all of a sudden is Kenny Omega. This guy's everywhere. Him and Don Callis popping up on everybody's TV show. You don't know where they're going to end up next. They may be on Raw tomorrow night. I mean, it would be in the Thunderdome. They'd be in one of those little boxes, but that actually would be kind of funny if they tried to sneak in and they can claim they were on Monday Night Raw as well. But anyway, thank you for tuning in this week as we count down the final episodes of 2020. And if you would like to support the podcast, you may always do so on thesolomonster.com. That is the place to go. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout out. I want to say thank you to all of our great VIPs, our producers for this week. Night Stalker, Naif Al-Safar, John Loose Cannon Lopez, the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, Ostentatious, Alan Carter. Thank you, Alan. Appreciate it. The Florida Freebird, Brian Becerra. Beast Mode, Brock Joseph. He wanted me to do the Josh Matthews way, which I guess would be Beast Mode, Brock Joseph. Something like that. Very tired this morning. My voice, I'm very tired. Not getting enough sleep. But thank you, Brock. Out of Control, Cody Thomas. Killshot, Keith Hart. Raymond the Mountie Medina. Sean Nasty Boy Nilsson. Dream Chaser, Chauncey Curry. The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, Stephen Handyman, Halistic, and the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep. Also want to give a shout out to Massgrave Micah Harshaw. You might have heard Micah's name a time or two. He's been a listener of the podcast now for many, many years. And he runs a small Mexican restaurant in downtown Indianapolis called the Tamale Place. Now, I remember him telling me about this a few years ago. It was a big dream of his to open that restaurant, and he's been operating it now for a number of years, and unfortunately, due to the pandemic, they will be closing their doors for good on December 23rd, and I know Micah is having a real tough time right now. I know he's resisted doing this, but he has started a GoFundMe just to try to keep his head above water while all of this is going on and while his business is about to go under. So I know these next few weeks especially are going to be tough for him. So if the Sound Off family would like to help out and show some love for Micah, you can search for his first and last name, Micah Harshaw, or the campaign name, which is Micah is Asking for Help. You can search either one of those things on the GoFundMe website. So go ahead and if you would like to support one of our longtime listeners, you may do so. I know And I know Mike is listening, and I know I told you this off air, but just hang tough, brother. Just hang tough. It's a shitty situation, and I know you're going to come out of it okay, but again, if anybody wants to help out, that is the place to go. There are more shout-outs coming up here in a little bit, so if you didn't hear your name, just stay tuned. Yet another death to lead off with this week. How many more weeks do we have left in this year? This is like the never-ending year. I can't wait until this year is in the rearview mirror. And hopefully things begin to turn around, because I feel like this has just been, for so many different reasons, this has been an awful year for so many people. And I feel like in wrestling, if you're a wrestling fan or you're in the wrestling business, have a lot of friends in the wrestling business, it just seems like it has been an exceptionally awful year. And not just because of all the speaking out stuff from earlier this year and all of that, but just the number of people that have passed away. And you can add another name to the list. Tommy Lister, also known as Tiny Lister, who played Zeus in the movie No Holds Barred opposite Hulk Hogan and feuded with Hogan on WWE television to help promote the movie, was found dead in his home on Thursday at the age of 62 of what authorities say seems to be natural causes, but his manager, Cindy Cowan, said he had gotten sick about a week ago, he couldn't breathe, he felt weak, and she thinks it may have been COVID. He apparently tested positive for COVID earlier this year and he beat it, but she seems to think that he either got it again or it had to do with his earlier diagnosis. We'll know soon enough, I guess, if more information comes out, but very sad to hear that. He had a very unique look as Zeus with that giant Z carved out in the side of his head and that eye. Yeah, he was born blind in his right eye. So I remember watching when I was a kid, I'm like, why does his eye look like that? I didn't know at the time that he was born, you know, blind in the eye. But that is how it came to look like that. No Holds Barred may be what wrestling fans most remember him for, but a lot more people know him from his role as Debo in the Friday movies. You know, he was in the Fifth Element. He's been in a lot of movies. He was in the Fifth Element. Jackie Brown was another one that I remember him being in. He was in one of the Austin Powers sequels. Or maybe there was only one sequel. How many sequels were there to Austin Powers? I know of one. I don't. Maybe they had more than that, but he was in one of those movies. And The Dark Knight, which is probably one of my, not probably, it is one of my top three favorite films of all time. And he had a role in that movie as well. A pretty important role, too. It was a small part, but it was a pretty important part of the movie. But his career is just, you can see his career just peppered with a lot of small roles and bit parts, but it just feels like he's been in so many different things. It's very impressive when you look at his filmography to see how many movies, not only that he was in, but even up until the day that he passed away, he's got something like half a dozen or a dozen different films that are still in pre-production. So he was working right up until the day of his death. For me, as a young Hulkamaniac, it was No Holds Barred, and Zeus scared the shit out of me. He legitimately scared me in the movie when he ripped that chunk of hair out of Stan Hansen's head in that barroom fight scene. And every time he would come on screen, the first time he popped up on screen and the menacing music in the background, it scared me, you know, when I watched that movie. Yeah, I don't know if he killed Stan Hansen in that scene or not, or he just ripped the hair out of his head. They certainly played it up like he was just dead. But they did a tremendous job of building this guy up as a villain. He played a convicted killer just out of prison. Had that movie really taken off, I feel like today, with all of the sequels and the prequels and everything we see in the movies today, if this had been a bigger deal, and maybe this had come out in more recent times, I feel like today, Zeus's backstory would be enough to warrant a prequel. Just to explore the backstory of how Zeus came to be Zeus. They do a lot of that these days, a lot of origin stories. I think that could have worked. I think that could have been interesting. But if you've never seen the movie, Vince McMahon personally financed the entire thing. It was a vehicle designed to promote Hulk Hogan as the next big movie star, the next big action star he was going to be the next Arnold Schwarzenegger or Sylvester Stallone. That was, I'm sure, kind of what they had in their heads. Randy Savage got the WWF title at WrestleMania 4 so that Hogan can go off and film No Holds Barred. And so in the movie, Hogan plays a wrestler named Rip, who did this weird gesture with his hand, and he would go, "Rip him, whoo!" You know, that was kind of his thing. He called himself Rip, but he was the WWF champion. And I always thought it was very silly that he wouldn't play himself in the movie, especially since you had Mean Gene Okerlund under that name and Jesse the Body Ventura under that name. And I just thought it was strange. Now, maybe it had something to do with Marvel Comics and they couldn't use the Hulk name in the movie. That's possible. But the top executive for a rival television network wants Rip to come work for him. And when he refuses, Mr. Brell, which is his name in the movie, Brell creates this underground fight competition called the Battle of the Tough Guys. This is basically Raw Underground before Raw Underground was a thing. You know, if they wanted Raw Underground to be a success, they should have brought back Kurt Fuller to reprise his role as Brell. Forget the fact that he was electrocuted at the end of the movie. We can forget about that. Right? I mean, the Dan Connor died at the end of Roseanne. They brought him back on the Connors. So sometimes you can just retcon that stuff, right? Let's pretend he didn't die at the end of the movie. You get Kurt Fuller to reprise his role as Brell. Bring back Brell. Brell could be like what Dario Cueto was on Lucha Underground. You bring him back, you bring back Zeus to beat the fuck out of Dolph Ziggler on Raw Underground. I would have tuned in to see that. I would not have skipped over those segments if they would have done that. But Brell in the movie, for some reason, had this very unhealthy obsession throughout the entire film of calling people jockasses. They weren't jackasses, they were jockasses. I still use that insult to this day, here and there. I never forgot that. I just thought it was such a unique way to insult somebody. I'd never heard that before, and I haven't heard that since. Jockass. I've heard of jock itch. I'd never heard of jock ass before. Maybe that's a different kind of jock itch. But it all builds to the final showdown between Rip and Zeus, and Hogan don't job, so you know how it ends. I'm not going to tell you that it's a great movie, because it's not. You can tell Vince McMahon came up with the script or had a lot of influence in the script because it has a lot of toilet humor and just the kind of humor that I'm sure would pop Vince McMahon. But I enjoyed it for what it was. I mean, I know Roger Ebert called it a disgusting film. He ranked it among the worst movies of the year. What did that guy know, though, right? It got a 10% fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes. Audiences seemed to like it a little bit more. They gave it 34%. No Holds Barred is the definition of a guilty pleasure for me. I bought the DVD a few years ago and they finally released it on DVD. And it needs to be said, it was genius for Vince McMahon to use a Hogan-Zeus feud on television as a way to try to sell the movie. Now, he had the greatest interest in wanting the movie to be a success because he financed it. So if he didn't at least break even, he would have lost his money. And when your money is on the line, it's amazing the lengths that you will go to make sure that it is a success. But it was actually very brilliant. Yeah, from a marketing perspective, it was brilliant on his part to use his own television shows as a means beyond just trailers and TV commercials. He could use his entire show. He can build an entire pay-per-view main event around the idea of promoting this film. When the movie came out, it was number 2 in its first week, behind one of the Indiana Jones movies. I think it made about $5 million in its first week. It was not anywhere close to the success that they were hoping it would be. I know there was an episode of Raw sometime late in 97 during the Monday Night War where Vince, on commentary, even joked. He took a dig at Hogan, saying that, you know, Hogan had promised to pay him his salary back or something if Vince didn't make his money back on the movie, so I guess the check is still in the mail. It was something like that. So it didn't do well. Didn't do well. But the way that they used Zeus was, again, brilliant. They never put him in a singles match because that would have been just a complete disaster. So they paired him off with Randy Savage. So I can't think of a better dance partner to have than the Macho Man. They paired him off with Randy Savage and Sensational Sherry. And they kept him limited to tag team matches. The SummerSlam 89 main event is actually a really fun match. And it did big business. And then they used Zeus very, very briefly. But they used him in a Survivor Series match that year where he wouldn't stop choking out Hulk Hogan at the very beginning of the match, and so he was quickly disqualified. And that built to No Holds Barred, the match, the movie, which was this pay-per-view that they put together in December. It was Hogan and Beefcake Barber. That's what Zeus would call him on TV. He would never called him Brutus. He never called him Brutus Beefcake. Never called him Brutus the Barber. It was Beefcake Barber. That's what he called him. So it was Hogan and Beefcake Barber against Zeus and the Macho King at this pay-per-view. And, you know, it was a match they taped weeks earlier at some TV taping, and then they just took the one match. It was a tag team match inside a steel cage. It took three leg drops, but Hogan, you know, he pinned Zeus, and he vanquished the bad guys, and that was the end of Zeus in the WWF. The story has always been that Vince McMahon's original idea, the original thought that he was considering, or and how serious it got, I don't know. But the original idea for WrestleMania 6 was to do Hogan one-on-one in the main event against Zeus and recreate the final match from the movie. Zeus himself claimed that Vince McMahon told him that he was going to put the belt on him and give him a run with the championship for a year. He said Hogan was going to get $2 million for the match at WrestleMania and he was going to get $500,000. And he says the deal had already been negotiated. Now, I don't know how much of that I believe, but I can believe that there was absolutely an idea to do the match at WrestleMania, and thank Christ it didn't happen. That would have been just a complete and total mess. Can you imagine Zeus as WWF champion for an entire year? I mean, I probably would take Zeus as the champion over the Great Khali, but the Great Khali was not the World Heavyweight Champion for a friggin' year. But imagine that, or imagine being screwed out of the Hogan Warrior main event for Hogan Zeus. But, you know, for an actor who admitted that he didn't know a damn thing about pro wrestling before he got into it, and when the idea was initially floated to him, hey, we're, you know, what do you think about doing some wrestling on the shows to help promote the movie? You know, his attitude at the time was, I'm not gay, I'm not going to touch these guys, and, you know, he was all like that, until he found out how much money they were going to pay him, and then he's like, okay, what guy do I need to touch? It's amazing how money can change your mind on things very quickly. But yeah, he didn't know anything about wrestling. To him, it was a bunch of guys, you know, just rolling around on the mat, and he didn't have any interest in doing that until he found out how much money he could make off it. But when he was, you know, protected and limited the way he was in WWE, he was fine. He looked the part. He was very scary to look at. In that situation, he was fine. But he worked a match in Puerto Rico against Abdullah the Butcher in the summer of 1990 as Zeus. And he claims that the promoters there, it was like a big anniversary show in Puerto Rico, and I guess they wanted to have almost like this freak show kind of attraction. And he claims they offered him $22,000 to do the match, just one match. But he had heard about, you know, how things could be in Puerto Rico and how dangerous it could be, so he took two LA police officers along on the trip with him, I guess that he was friendly with, just to watch his back and make sure that nothing happened, because he was made aware of the whole Bruiser Brody thing, and he didn't trust that, you know, something might not happen to him, and so he brought the two officers along with him. So if you have any doubts that a singles match at WrestleMania would have been among the worst WrestleMania main events of all time, go watch the match on YouTube between Zeus and Abdullah the Butcher. It is as bad as it sounds. It is not good, it is not passable, it is awful, it is dreadful, it is one of the worst matches that I have ever seen. But he ranked number 500 in the very first PWI 500 list in 1991, which is a mystery to me because the man wrestled 5 matches in his entire career, 3 of which were in 1989 and one very awful one in 1990. That was it. And yet he ranked, the fact that he ranked at all in 91 is just mystifying to me. The only other match that he worked was 5 years later. Hogan got him into WCW as part of the alliance to end Hulkamania, because Hulk needed some big guys, some big villains to beat. That's what Hogan was all about, really, that whole 1995-96 period before, you know, pre-NWO in WCW. It just felt like it was this one giant period of Hogan feuding with the Dungeon of Doom and getting jobs for guys like Kamala and Earthquake and all these people who he could just beat. You know, because Hogan was the big hero, and so he could beat the big guys. And so they had this thing, the alliance to end Hulkamania. They brought in Zeus. I guess they couldn't call him Zeus. So they brought him in as Z-Gangsta. Or as Tony Schiavone used to call him, Z-Gangster. Because he's the whitest man in America. They brought him in to be part of this absolutely horrendous doomsday cage match at Uncensored 96, where Hulk Hogan and Randy Savage had to run the gauntlet. It was like this triple cage deal, years before WCW did the whole triple cage thing, and they had to run the gauntlet against, and I had to look up the team because I forgot all the names of the different members. I remembered Luger and Flair and then, you know, Z-Gangsta, but it was Lex Luger, Ric Flair, Arn Anderson, The Barbarian, Kevin Sullivan, Meng, Z-Gangsta, and The Ultimate Solution, who was played by Jeep Swenson, which might be a name you've heard of before. Swenson used to be a wrestler. He was an actor, a stuntman actor. You know, he did that for a number of years. He was also in No Holds Barred. He actually played the role of Lugwrench, who is one of the tough guys that Zeus beat or killed or something. So Hogan got his old movie buddies a couple of paydays, and of course the Mega Powers won, 8-2, and the Mega Powers won. Like John Cena and Randy Orton beating the entire Raw roster. Although I think that was 17-2, if I remember. So that was worse. But when WCW initially brought Jeep Swenson in, they called him the Final Solution. The Final Solution is what the Nazis called their plan to kill the Jews during the Holocaust. So that didn't go over very well. And they quickly changed his name to The Ultimate Solution. But I was reading an old Grantland article about Lister. And I was reading about some of the mortgage fraud stuff that he was accused of. He pled guilty to a mortgage fraud scheme a number of years ago. But they interviewed Hogan for this article, and they were just to talk about the Zeus stuff, not the mortgage stuff. And in that SummerSlam match in 89, Hogan and Beefcake had an expression that they would use. It was like their safe word for Zeus. I mean, I hate to put that image in your heads, but that's basically what it was. It was basically a safe word or a safe expression that they would use when Zeus got a little too rough with them in the ring, and that was Free James Brown. James Brown at the time was behind bars, I don't remember for what, but he was in jail. And whenever they wanted to calm down Zeus, if they had, let's say he had them in a bear hug, which is one of the only moves he knew, right? A big guy. So what do? You pick the guy up, put him in a bear hug. If he was squeezing too tight, if he was just being too rough in the ring, or just was too amped up, their way of calming him down and trying to make him laugh or whatever, because he found it amusing, they would say, Free James Brown. And then he would loosen up, and he would calm down a little bit. Hogan used it on the set of the movie, too. And one time, he accidentally broke Zeus's nose, and he was worried, because he didn't know what his reaction would be. He didn't know if this guy was going to beat the fuck out of him. And when he did, when he broke his nose, he said Zeus just looked at him, and he said, I thought you loved me. What about James Brown? So this is some funny stories like that. Some I knew, some I didn't know. But he will always have his place in wrestling history, and it was a very memorable character. It was a very memorable role. Again, maybe not the greatest movie in the world, but as somebody who was growing up at that time, fan of the product, and I very vividly remember all of the promotion for this movie. I thought they did a masterful job of building that character up and making him seem intimidating and doing their best to hide his, and he had a lot of weaknesses, but doing their best to hide those weaknesses and just use him for what he was really good at, which was just standing there and scaring the hell out of people like me. So I was very sorry to hear about his death this week. Some more shout-outs here. I want to say thank you to Mean Matt Forbush. Thank you for the PayPal. Josh the Shooter Stockton, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, the Carolina Panther, Bradley Gooch, the Wichita Workhorse, Clayton Nettleton, New York Punk, Arnold Modesto, the Can't Miss Prospect, Josh Kaysen, Masked Maniac, Mark O'Shea, and Final Boss, Brian Dudley, who is celebrating a birthday this Wednesday, so happy birthday to Brian. Also, Belt Fan Brent Banner. This week on his How Did We Even Get Here podcast, Brent loses a date and misses his shot while Trey loses his mind. Find the How Did We Even Get Here podcast on all podcast platforms and on YouTube at tinyurl.com/gethere-tube. There is an insane amount of news to get to this week, and I'm going to cover all the key stuff. I am going to talk about this proposed card, which may or may not be true, but we're going to talk about it anyway. The card for WrestleMania, the Bill Goldberg stuff, the Keith Lee stuff, a lot of AEW news and notes, including something that JR said that was a bit controversial this week, at least as far as members of the AEW roster is concerned. So we're going to get into all of that. But first, we got to talk about the most important thing, which is that WWE is resurrecting the Slammy Awards for the first time in 5 years, airing live on the WWE Network at 10 a.m. Eastern on Wednesday, December 23rd. I don't know if they're just taping acceptance speeches with the winners that week, you know, at the Raw and SmackDown tapings, and then they're just going to splice them into a special that is probably going to be hosted, I assume, by the people who host The Bump and some of the online stuff for WWE. Or if they're going to have wrestlers zooming in live that morning to accept their awards, since everything is on friggin' Zoom or Skype these days. But this will not look like the Slammy Award shows of old. Unfortunately, there will not be Todd Pettengill on stage singing a song and, you know, all of the fun stuff they did back in the late 90s at some of those Slammy Award shows. But here are the categories. Just run through these and I will chime in with my thoughts. I'm going to hold off on giving my match of the year and superstar of the year choices since I'm probably going to be doing that on the Sound Off in the next few weeks. So I'll hold off on that. But the category of superstar of the year, the nominees are Drew McIntyre, Roman Reigns, Randy Orton, Braun Strowman. Braun Strowman, The Fiend, Bray Wyatt, Asuka, Sasha Banks, Bayley, Becky Lynch, who missed most of this year, and Charlotte Flair, who also missed a good chunk of the year. Match of the year. These are the nominees. Becky Lynch against Asuka at the 2020 Royal Rumble. The Men's Royal Rumble match from earlier this year. Undertaker against AJ Styles at WrestleMania in the Boneyard match. Edge against Randy Orton at Backlash in the greatest wrestling match ever. AJ Styles against Daniel Bryan in the finals of the Intercontinental title tournament. AJ, Sami Zayn, and Jeff Hardy, the triple threat ladder match at Clash of Champions. Roman Reigns against Jey Uso for the Universal title at Hell in a Cell. In the Hell in a Cell I Quit match. Sasha Banks against Bayley at Hell in a Cell for the SmackDown Women's Championship. Drew McIntyre against Roman Reigns at Survivor Series. And The New Day against The Hurt Business from the November 16th episode of Monday Night Raw. All good choices. There's probably only two that I would leave off my list. Becky against Asuka may have been a good match at the Rumble, but it was not match of the year. And neither was the New Day against the Hurt Business. I'm not even sure why the hell that's on this list. Might have been match of the week. Might have been match of the month. But it certainly was not match of the year. Actually, it wasn't match of the month either. So I don't know why it's on this list. Other than they just felt, well, we got to put a tag match or we have to put a recent match on there. So let's just put this one on there. Rivalry of the year. Seth Rollins against the Mysterio family. Drew McIntyre against Randy Orton. Edge versus Randy Orton. Sasha Banks against Bayley. R-Truth against The World. And Lana against announce tables. Sasha Banks against Bayley is the rivalry of the year from that list. I look at all those choices, the answer is Sasha Banks against Bayley. Nothing was promoted, and I know they weren't feuding, so they weren't rivals necessarily for much of the year, but the way that that story built up, and as long as they put into it, you know, and it built up to that one point where Bayley turned on Sasha, that gets my pick. Of the nominees on this list, this gets my pick for the WWE Rivalry of the Year. Then we have Tag Team of the Year, the Golden Role Models, Sasha and Bayley, Nia Jax and Shayna Baszler, The New Day, The Street Profits, and Shinsuke Nakamura and Cesaro. I'm going to go with the Golden Role Models. I would pick Sasha and Bayley as Tag Team of the Year. Return of the Year. Edge, Roman Reigns, MVP, Goldberg, and Sami Zayn. I gotta go with Roman Reigns for Return of the Year. Roman Reigns has been just on fire ever since he came back. I didn't think they would have the guts to turn him heel, but I didn't realize once they did how good he would really be. And it's only been a few months. And he has already just shot up to the top of the list as being probably the only really must-see thing about WWE television right now is the stuff that Roman Reigns is doing and the stuff that he is involved in. So to me, the return of the year in this company is easy. The answer is Roman Reigns. They have Ring Gear of the Year. The nominees are Who Gives a Shit? Breakout Star of the Year. Dominic Mysterio. Bianca Belair. Otis. The Street Profits. And Murphy. Breakout Star of the Year, from the names on that list, I probably would go with Dominic Mysterio. Dominic, I think, impressed a lot of people. He impressed me. I didn't expect him to be as good as he was. I'm not saying he's unbelievable, but you know, for a kid who got thrown right into the fire. I mean, his first singles match ever was at SummerSlam against Seth Rollins. And I thought he knocked it out of the park. And really, in a lot of the matches that he was in, I thought he did a very good job. And I think the future looks very bright for Dominic. He kind of came out of nowhere for me. He would get my pick for Breakout Star of the Year. I already knew how good Bianca Belair is, and she debuted so late into the year. And even really, up until maybe a month ago or a few weeks ago, even after she had debuted on the main roster, she kind of disappeared there for a little while. So they weren't even really doing much with her. She's going to go on to become one of the big breakout stars in this company in the next, probably for the next few years. But for this year, I got to go with Dominic. Female Superstar of the Year, Asuka, Sasha Banks, Bayley, Becky Lynch, or Charlotte Flair. Female Star of the Year, I got to go with Asuka. Asuka was really an MVP in that company for many, many months after Becky left. She sort of... It's almost as if she passed the torch, literally in the ring, and passed it to Asuka. And it's sad now that Asuka really doesn't have anything to do on the show. They have her doing stuff with Lana. It's a complete waste, an absolute waste of what Asuka can bring to the table. But she has been a very, very important part. I mean, imagine how much worse that Raw women's roster would be if they didn't have Asuka around. Male Superstar of the Year... Drew McIntyre, Roman Reigns, Randy Orton, Braun Strowman, and The Fiend, Bray Wyatt. I'll let you guys decide who you think is the men's star of the year. And finally, moment of the year. Edge returns in the men's Royal Rumble match. Drew McIntyre defeats Brock Lesnar at WrestleMania 36. Becky Lynch announces her pregnancy. Yes, this is one of the moments of the year in the running here for the award. Roman Reigns and Paul Heyman unite. Bayley betrays Sasha Banks. And The New Day gets drafted to different brands. The New Day's farewell address. And finally, The Undertaker's quote-unquote final farewell. The moment of the year, for me, is Edge returning at the Royal Rumble. That was I know there had been rumors about it. It wasn't a complete and total shock, but it was very surprising to see him come back. And he's very fortunate that it came at a time when we still had full packed buildings. So you had a baseball stadium with 40,000 people, right? Or 50,000 people who gave him this hero's welcome. They were so happy and so shocked to see him coming out to, you know, Metalingus, and here he comes. And it was such a great moment. And that's why I didn't pick Edge for the return of the year, because I think Roman Reigns deserves that. But I did pick this for moment of the year. It's got to be Edge coming out, buzzer goes off, his music hits, and the building just goes apeshit. So I'm picking Edge as the moment of the year. So those are your Slammy Awards categories. And again, they'll be picking the winners in a couple of weeks. That'll be airing on the WWE Network, and I'll probably have some picks of my own here on the podcast in the next few weeks. WrestleVotes tweeted this week. A source of theirs stressed that while nothing is official, there is a working idea for the top of the card at WrestleMania next year. And right now that idea looks to be, for the top three matches, Roman Reigns defending the Universal Championship against Bill Goldberg, Edge wrestles Randy Orton, and a triple threat match, I presume, for the WWE Championship with Drew McIntyre, Keith Lee, and Brock Lesnar. They also said the question of how many people may or may not be allowed to attend the show will also play a role in what the final card looks like, because there could be some matches they want to do that are really, you know, they think are really big matches, but they don't want to do it in a mostly empty stadium. So they would rather wait until they can get, you know, a building full of 20,000 people or a stadium full of 50,000 people and not do a stadium show with 15,000 people all spaced out. Now you take these things about early WrestleMania plans with a grain of salt, because these people don't know what they're doing from one week to the next. How many times do we have to hear about stories of Vince McMahon rewriting scripts and people don't know what they're doing on the show that night until 7:53 p.m.? These people don't know what they're doing from one week to the next. So I am skeptical that they have anything concrete mapped out for WrestleMania next year. But let's assume that these matches are being considered right now. And honestly, they're not that far off, because Goldberg went public this week with some comments. And, you know, Edge and Randy Orton, I think, has been expected pretty much all year. I think most people assume that we're going to get Edge and Orton Part 3. So these matches really are not that far-fetched. But you look at this card, if this is accurate, and basically what they're doing is they're redoing the WrestleMania 36 card at WrestleMania 37. Only this time it's going to be outdoors, hopefully they think in front of fans, and Keith Lee is thrown into the mix. That's about it. That's about the only difference. Now, Edge and Orton, like I said, was always expected. I don't really have a great desire to see it again, honestly. I don't. We saw it at WrestleMania. We saw it at Backlash. Edge won the first one, Orton won the second one, so, oh, we gotta have a third one, right? We gotta have the rubber match. No, we don't. But their first two matches took place in front of exactly zero fans. I'm not counting the wrestlers that were at ringside for the second one. So this time, they would be able to do the match that they wanted to do in March. They would be able to go to Tampa. They would be able to do it in a big stadium outdoors. Edge can come out, get his big altar bridge entrance, and they would have some people in the stadium. I would like to just move past this. I would like to see Edge have, you know, matches and be in the ring with someone other than just Randy Orton. And the name that comes to mind for me, and somebody who apparently is not factored into WrestleMania plans this early, is AJ Styles. He's a man with no obvious WrestleMania match at this point. So yes, it will probably be Edge and Orton as long as Edge is all healed up from his injury. But if they got away from this and did Edge and AJ Styles instead, I would have more interest in that. Now, we already saw Drew McIntyre pin Brock Lesnar at WrestleMania this year, 4 Claymore kicks. Why the hell do we need to see this match again? The answer is we don't. We don't need to see this match again. This is all assuming that they even sign Brock Lesnar to a new deal, because right now, remember, he is not under contract to WWE. He is a free agent. Throwing Keith Lee into the match, it does make the match more interesting, but they could also save McIntyre for Roman Reigns. Or even maybe a title defense against Sheamus, which they're building to very nicely. I almost think that they got to be careful that they don't kind of build to it a little too quickly. But that absolutely could be the championship match at WrestleMania. And instead, you do Keith Lee. If you can bring Brock back, you do Keith Lee one-on-one with Brock Lesnar. I love their little interaction at the Royal Rumble match this year. So I think a one-on-one match between those two guys could be fun. But, you know, if this triple threat becomes a thing, this is the match that I find the most interesting of the three that were mentioned. And I think it could be an excellent match. Brock has been part of some excellent multi-man matches before. Brock Lesnar is part of one of my favorite triple threat matches of all time in WWE. Right? He doesn't have to do much. You can take him out of the match. He can lay down and he could take a rest, and then Drew and Keith Lee could do most of the work, and then boom, here comes Brock. As long as Brock doesn't go over, I think we're kind of beyond that at this point. But then we get to Roman Reigns and Bill Goldberg. Goldberg has stated before that his deal with WWE runs through, I think, the end of 2022, and he is obligated to do 2 matches per year. I guess they could always pay him to do more, but he's obligated to 2 matches per year. I'm sure at least one of which would be in Saudi Arabia. They were going to do Roman Reigns against Goldberg this year at WrestleMania, but Roman pulled himself off the card. So I figured they would eventually do this match at some point. Goldberg all but confirmed it on The Bump this week. They had him on as a guest to promote his new WWE Untold documentary, which I actually think it debuts today on the network. It's about the streak. So they had him on to talk about it. And this is what Goldberg had to say about Roman Reigns. He said, "He backed out on me at WrestleMania. He stole my move God knows how long ago. While he continues to perform at a, or I guess perform the move, at a subpar level. Let's be perfectly honest. I'm the dude who delivers the spear, and I don't think he understands what it's like until I deliver one to him. So Roman, it's coming, and I'm coming for you. I may be old, I may be gray, but I am still Goldberg." I want to talk about something great that I saw on Talking Smack yesterday. Paul Heyman was once again on the show, co-hosting with Kayla Braxton, and they had Big E stop by the set as a guest. And Paul Heyman is sitting there and he's staring at Big E and he is endlessly singing this man's praises and he's talking about all of his potential. And then he ended with a question. A statement first and then a question. He looked at Big E dead in the eye and he said, "You have to accept in your heart that the New Day will only be a footnote in the story of the greatness of Big E." And then he said, "If I may ask a question, when was the last time you saw Roman Reigns in the ring and anybody even bothered to mention the Shield?" And Big E just sat there speechless and didn't know how to respond. And I bring this up because there are so many more interesting matches for Roman Reigns at WrestleMania that do not involve Bill Goldberg. The fact that they still want to fall back on Goldberg for this match because they both used the spear, and one went to Georgia, and the other went to Georgia Tech, as if any of us who didn't go to Georgia or Georgia Tech or live in Georgia even give a shit about that, is a perfect example of why we look at these WrestleMania cards every year, and I have to listen to people say, well, Goldberg's a bigger star, Solomonster, you know, he appeals to a more casual audience. Let me ask you a question. How many years in a row are you going to give me that lame excuse before it finally hits you, before like a bolt of lightning to the brain, that there is something wrong here? The fact that you have to keep telling me that every single year and it never seems to change, year after year, like a pull-string doll. Do you not see something wrong with that? Why is that? If that's the case, why is that? It's because they do a piss-poor job of making the younger guys feel as special as the older guys. And look, part of it is nostalgia. And I'm all for a little bit of nostalgia. But Bill Goldberg has been back now for 4 fucking years. He won the Universal title twice. He embarrassed The Fiend. He almost paralyzed The Undertaker. We are past the point of nostalgia with Bill Goldberg. Goldberg can have a place on the show. That place is not in the main event of WrestleMania. At least The Rock. You're going to look at a guy from the past who's almost 50 years old. At least The Rock, right, has this built-in, ready-to-go, perfect storyline setup for a match with Roman Reigns, but Vince McMahon supposedly does not want to do the match. I don't know The Rock could do it anyway. We've already talked about this, all of his obligations and insurance and this and that, but supposedly Vince McMahon is not too keen on doing the match at WrestleMania next year because he wants there to be fans in the stadium, and he wants more than 10,000 people in the stadium. He doesn't want to do Rock and Roman Reigns in front of 5 or 10 or 15,000 people in a giant football stadium. So, fine. Goldberg has 2 matches per year, right, that he's supposedly committed for. Do the match at the Royal Rumble. And save WrestleMania as a spot for a match against somebody like Big E. Or Daniel Bryan. Or even Drew McIntyre. As great as their match was at Survivor Series, I want to see it again. That's 3 current roster names I just gave you, all of whom would make perfectly fine opponents for Roman Reigns. The only reason I see not to do the match with Big E at WrestleMania is because they don't want Roman to lose. It's very possible Roman goes to WrestleMania and he retains the Universal Championship and they keep the belt on him for another 6 months. If they want to hold off on the match for that reason, maybe for SummerSlam, okay, I can understand that. Then it makes sense to run with somebody like Daniel Bryan, who does not have to win, but he is a fan favorite that people are going to root for and get behind with a backstory that aligns perfectly with the backstory of Roman Reigns. You could take this thing all the way back to 2015 and save the Big E match, because it looks like Big E may be going after the Intercontinental title right now. It doesn't mean he's going to win it, but okay, fine, then save the Big E match if you're not ready to take the title just yet off of Roman Reigns. You know, Goldberg also gave an interview to Bleacher Report, said that Randy Orton is another name that he would like to get into the ring with. You want Goldberg on the WrestleMania card? Here's what you can do. Put Edge with AJ Styles and put Randy Orton with Bill Goldberg. And then that way you get 2 big matches out of it instead of 1. Leave the championship match for somebody more interesting. Leave the championship match for somebody who's actually on the fucking roster. Have a little faith. Have a little faith in your own roster and trust in them. And maybe one of these days, maybe, just maybe one of these days, those people will appeal to the casual audience the way that apparently everybody loves to say all the old guys do. Yeah, they appeal to the mainstream audience so much that maybe they'll pop 1 rating on TV and then things go right back to the way they were. I question that, by the way. I want to see the proof of that. that there's this great mass appeal for people like Bill Goldberg after he's already been back for 4 years. It was there at the beginning. There was an excitement, I think, at the beginning about Goldberg being back and getting back in the ring with Brock Lesnar. That was 4 years ago. Am I still going to be getting emails from people 5 years from now when Goldberg's been back for a decade telling me, well, you know, there's nostalgia? That's not what nostalgia is. Nostalgia is you bring somebody back, you have like a reunion tour or a comeback tour or one or two appearances. There's a reason why when Hulk Hogan would come back, he wasn't around for very long. He would come back, he'd be back for a few months, and then he would disappear. Because he was smart enough to know that if I stick around, brother, the numbers aren't going to be so hot anymore. People aren't going to be as excited to see me. So I'll step away, and then 9 months from now, I'll come back again, and I'll get to, everybody gets all excited to see me again. He was smart. That's nostalgia. Nostalgia will only take you so far. 4 years he's been back. 2 world titles. At what point do you say enough is enough? I have nothing against seeing the old guys being used. I think there could be a spot for them. They don't have as many of them left as they used to. Every year that goes by, whether Chris Jericho leaves and goes to AEW, or The Undertaker retires, Triple H, when was the last time we saw Triple H wrestle a match? Right? Probably one of the Saudi shows. So there are fewer and fewer of these names left. But I do think you can find a place for them. I have nothing against seeing Sting on AEW television. But I would be sitting here telling you the same exact thing if Tony Khan booked Sting against Kenny Omega for the AEW World Championship. Enough. Let's move on. Asking Vince McMahon to have a little bit of faith in his roster might be wishful thinking, though. This is the same man who, 6 years ago on his own network, told Steve Austin that the roster now is full of millennials who don't want it. They don't want it the way that you did, Steve. You and all those guys from the Attitude Era roster and all those people, they don't want it the way that you do. And whether you believe that or not is not even the point. This is what he thinks. I don't need to be in the creative meetings. I don't need to be in his inner circle to know where Vince McMahon's head is at. He said this in his own words. The roster is full of millennials. They don't want it. They don't have the passion for it the way that you did. So is it any wonder why he keeps taking his DeLorean back to the future every single year? Can't do that anymore with The Undertaker. Or can he? Of course he can. He'd scrape his dead corpse off the floor if he needed a main event for one of his shows bad enough. So we already know what Vince McMahon thinks of the current roster. He does not think very highly of them, but for a few exceptions. But for a handful of people, he doesn't seem to care very much about his current roster. He sure as hell doesn't think much of the talent from NXT. All you got to do is watch the shows every week to see that. But now we learn from PW Insider and The Observer and Fightful that a number of WWE talents, all of them big men, have been ordered to the Performance Center recently by Vince McMahon to work on refining and improving their in-ring skills. And that contingent includes Keith Lee, Otis, Dio Madden, who portrays Mace from Retribution. Another example of what Vince McMahon thinks of NXT talent. I give you Exhibit A with Retribution. Need I say more? Yabba Dabba Doo Guy from Raw Underground has also been ordered back to the PC. And AJ Styles' bodyguard, Omos. They've all been taking part in regular workouts at the PC on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And Meltzer said that Vince McMahon threw a fit about the working ability of some of these guys on the main roster, and he was especially angry about some of the big guys, which is what led to this. So now they're taking classes at the PC, led by Adam Pearce and Drew Gulak. According to Fightful, upon learning of this news, many WWE talents that they reached out to were said to be baffled at the inclusion of Keith Lee on that list. They also said there are a couple of things that have caught the attention of backstage officials in recent weeks regarding Otis's matches, specifically the idea that he could work safer in the ring. Keith Lee almost killed himself on a dive a few weeks ago on TV. I would not be surprised if that was the spot that Vince blew a gasket. You know my thoughts on the dives. Wait until I get to the AEW news here in a little bit. And the comments that Jim Ross made that upset a lot of the wrestlers in the back. But dives aside, I've never seen anybody in interviews, other wrestlers who have praised Keith Lee and talked about him. Keith Lee just had, a 24th special on the WWE Network. And even Vince, in one of the scenes, was in the back with him putting him over. I've never heard or read or seen anybody question the in-ring ability of Keith Lee. Keith Lee was signed to a contract because they liked what he brought to the table. He was pushed in NXT and he was made a double champion because the man is a star. And if this proves nothing else, it proves that Vince McMahon does not spend 1 second of his time paying any attention to what is happening in NXT. And it explains so much about why these NXT talents have such a difficult time when they hit the main roster. Why they build up this personality and this profile and this career for themselves in NXT, only for it to be changed and manipulated and ruined in many cases once they hit the main roster. Because Vince McMahon, it's as if he is seeing these people for the very first time. The idea that I am sitting here right now talking about Keith Lee being sent back to the PC for training. After all of the times you have heard me talk about Nia Jax needs to go back to the Performance Center. If there's ever an example of somebody who was called up way too soon and could have benefited from spending another year, or however much time down, at the time, you know, I thought the whole idea was that it was supposed to be developmental. That was the original idea anyway about NXT and the Performance Center. If anybody could have benefited from spending more time down there, it was Nia Jax. Someone like that would benefit from being sent back down for refinement and training. And yet here I am sitting, talking about Keith Lee being among the names sent back for refinement and training. The fact that I am doing that is a disgrace. Now, if Keith Lee was sent to the Performance Center to assist with those other names, that would be different. I mean, part of me wants to give them the benefit of the doubt here, but I can't. I've been burned too many times by doing that. That would make more sense. Daba Kato and Omos, they're still very inexperienced, so I'm sure they could benefit from something like this. This is not an entirely horrible idea when you look at some of the names on that list. If Keith Lee was there to be another big man that they could spar with and they can learn from, that I could look at and say, you know what, that makes sense. But the way these reports are worded, you would think that they were sending him back to wrestling school. Shane Helms was one of the backstage producers who was furloughed earlier this year by WWE. He was recently brought back, and he tweeted this. He said, players that make it to the NBA, the NHL, the NFL, don't stop practicing and drilling just because they made it to the top. Being signed to a major promotion does not mean that you stop trying to perfect your craft. That is when you work even harder to perfect your craft. Not that he's wrong. You should always try to improve and better yourself at whatever it is that you do. But he has to know that the people who are hearing this news, and the reason people are so upset, they're upset about a name like Keith Lee being included on that list. And the fact that he would tweet that comes across as a dig at Keith Lee. So either there's something about Keith Lee that I'm just not seeing when I watch him on TV, or these people are out of their fucking minds. But if Vince McMahon thinks that all these new guys don't know how to work, and he puts them on TV before realizing this, you know what? Maybe do a better job of paying attention to your own product. You know who does pay attention to their product? Fubo. They pay attention to their product. Before I cut the cord from cable this year, one of the things that stopped me from making the move was that I was worried about what I would be losing, especially with live sports. But once I finally made the move, I felt like a damn fool for waiting so long. With Fubo TV, you're not just covered with live sports. You can watch on demand, whenever you want, no bulky box to worry about. Fubo gives you access to over 100 channels, including the major broadcast and cable networks, all for a fraction of what cable would cost you, including cloud DVR and the ability to stream your shows on your TV or any other smart device. And the layout is really easy to use. If you want to find what you're looking for, everything is organized up top by category, like sports, shows, movies. They have a little live guide link you can click on. They have a section with all of your recordings organized in one place. If you're a sports nut especially, Fubo is what you want to be using. They've got the NFL, NBA, Major League Baseball, the Premier League, college sports, and more. And here's where it gets sweet. You can get full access to Fubo TV free for a few days. Right now, Fubo TV is offering our listeners the free trial and 15% off your first month by going to FuboTV.com/Solomonster. There are no contracts and you can cancel anytime. Go to FuboTV.com/Solomonster for a free trial and 15% off your first month. That's FuboTV.com/Solomonster. Some random raw thoughts from Monday night, a show where honestly, nothing of any real significance happened. It was very sad to see them give away a match between Asuka and Shayna Baszler that just felt so meaningless, only to build to a tag team match with Asuka and Lana against Shayna and Nia, and it ends with a distraction roll-up win for Asuka. You throw in a dive and a kendo stick and they would have hit the hat trick. Asuka and Shayna could have been a big deal. I think it's possible it could still be at some point. And here it was just another throwaway match on TV. It was another loss for Retribution, with Reckoning taking the fall again to Dana Brooke in a mixed tag team match. It was Ricochet and Dana against Reckoning and Slapdick. Mustafa Ali was yelling at both of them after the match for being losers, and then he walked out. So things are going well with Retribution. When Vince McMahon wonders why nobody can get over his stars anymore and he has to rely on people like Bill Goldberg, I hope he looks at Retribution. And some thought occurs to him that, you know what? Maybe we ought to do a better job. Maybe we could do a little bit better at giving people a reason to actually care about the new guys and think that they're cool instead of thinking that they're all just a bunch of losers. Matt Riddle. You see what they've been doing with Matt Riddle on the show. They're using him for comedy. Bro this and bro that. This week it was bro nuts. He walked around, and that's not some kind of new jockstrap he invented. It's his version of donuts. He calls them bro nuts. He walked around with a box of bro nuts, offering them to different people. He approached Jeff Hardy before Jeff Hardy's match with Bobby Lashley. He was offering him some bro nuts. He had a great idea. He thought that the Hardy Boys are one of the greatest tag teams of all time. But if the two of them team together, and it's funny too because he fucked it all up. He actually gave the punchline before he could set it up. He was supposed to mention the Hardy Bros was like the big punchline, and he blew it too early, and Jeff kind of laughed. But yes, that was the payoff to this segment here. You and I, man, we could be the Hardy Bros. And Jeff Hardy seemed amused. He said, look, I got a match. I got to get out of here. And it was Lashley and Jeff Hardy. Lashley ended up getting the win with the Hurt Lock. Riddle did come down in the middle of the match when MVP was getting involved. So Riddle was down there. So obviously they're going to do something with Riddle and with Jeff Hardy. Now there is a report that Vince McMahon likes Matt Riddle. He doesn't know why he does the bro thing so much. He doesn't really get him. He doesn't get Matt Riddle. There's a lot of things Vince McMahon doesn't get, but he doesn't get Matt Riddle. But he is amused by him. He likes him. He's amused by him. And he's like his little pet clown, I guess. And so he wants to make sure that he is on television, which is good for Riddle, I guess, right? It gets him TV time. At least Vince McMahon wants him on TV. I think that and apparently the other part of this is that he doesn't view him as being a main event star, but he views him as somebody on the card who could just be there to entertain and be, you know, they could plug him in on the show wherever they need him. I disagree in that I think he can be a main event star, not right now, but he could be a main event star one day. And I think he is somebody who is actually hurt. And I think a lot of guys on the roster are hurt. And this may be part of the reason why a lot of this stuff is going on. We see Vince McMahon is throwing a fit. This guy is not getting over and this guy doesn't know how to work and this and that. And Matt Riddle is a victim of this too. And that is the fact that we are living in a time, as we have for most of this year, where there are no fans in attendance at these shows. And I guarantee you that there are people right now who this company is looking at and saying it's not working, they're not getting over, and now they're not being pushed. Where if we had people in the audiences and people in the crowds, there are people who would be over and would be getting a push, and their career would look very different. So there are people actively being hurt by the fact that there are no audiences, and the only thing that these people have to go on, the only thing that Vince McMahon and Bruce Pritchard and Kevin Dunn and all these people have to go on, is their gut. And think about how scary that is. They can only go on their gut because they're sweetening the crowd. They got their fake crowd piped in noise and chants and stuff. So you don't have any crowd, you know, genuine crowd reactions. They're just going on who they think is over and who they think is not over. And I said this was going to be a problem from the very beginning, and there's not a whole lot you can do about that until the pandemic is to a point where it's safe enough to get crowds of people back together. That is not WWE's fault, but I said this is what was going to end up happening here. They must be in seventh heaven right now because they can manipulate and control the crowd any which way they want. And they're the judge, jury, and executioner of who's getting over and who's not. Their whole business is built on the idea that you listen to the fans. You go on the road. You go to the buildings. You listen. You watch. You see how the fans are reacting to different people. Are they sitting on their hands? Are they cheering? Are they putting signs together? Are they hijacking the show for this person or that person like they did with Daniel Bryan a few years ago? And you have none of that now. All they have to go on is who they think is over. And that is a dangerous, dangerous thing. And I think Matt Riddle is one of the people who would be over, who would be getting a positive reception from the audience, and who is not. And so they only view him, I think, as being at a certain level. But I think the Hardy Bros thing, I mean, look, I'm not the biggest fan of these makeshift tag teams and taking two singles guys and just fusing them together. I think the Hardy Bros would, I'll say this much, I think it would work a lot better if they didn't take his first name away from him. Then you would have Matt and Jeff, the Hardy Bros. So give the man his name back. And then the Hardy Bros thing works even better. Kofi Kingston pinned Shelton Benjamin, but then, like he did with Xavier Woods previously, Cedric Alexander got on the microphone. He goaded Kofi in coming back to the ring for a second straight match. Kofi was selling a knee injury. He was kind of limping around. And, you know, they do this with the heels. And Cedric went on to win. He beat Kofi, but they do this with the heels where, why can't they just win? Why do the babyfaces need a built-in excuse when they lose? How do any heels get over that way? Why can't the heels just win? Did he really need to sell an injury? He was already wrestling two matches, so you could have just said, well, you know, this was Kofi's second match. He was worn out from the first one, and that would have been an excuse too. But they do these things, and it's like, just let them win. Stop making them look so weak. So this is their way, I guess, of giving us a reason to see, probably at TLC, a third tag team title match between the New Day and the Hurt Business. New Day already beat them twice. This is their way of getting to a third match. And with Jeff Hardy and Matt Riddle both having issues with the Hurt Business and seemingly about to come together, I think Cedric and Shelton are finally, a third time's a charm, I think they're finally going to win the tag team titles. And yeah, maybe not right away, but I think they win the titles from the New Day, because what the hell do the New Day need to carry these belts around for at this point? And the titles come off the Hurt Business and end up on the Hardy Bros. And that's your way of getting the titles off the New Day without having the New Day lose to Jeff and Matt. And they end up beating the Hurt Business for the belts. They are furthering the story. They are furthering the relationship, the friendship on TV between Drew McIntyre and Sheamus, which is one of the parts of the show that I have enjoyed lately. And there has not been much to like about Monday Night Raw. Monday Night Raw is the worst show that I review and talk about. It's not even a review. I can't stomach doing an entire Raw review. That's why you don't see me go live on YouTube on Monday nights. I can't do it. Can't do it. Can't bring myself to do it. And I don't want to, you know, cannibalize the main show. But if I loved watching the show and I thought the interest would be there, then I would do it. And I don't, because it is the worst show that I talk about on television every single week. It's an important show. It is still the flagship show. And there's a lot of people who don't watch the show, who rely on me to find out what the hell is going on Monday Night Raw. But it is by far, of all the shows I watch, SmackDown, NXT, AEW, even if I branch off every now and then I have time if I'm watching an NWA show or something, by far the worst show that I talk about every single week is Monday Night Raw. And so when there's something really good on Raw, it stands out to me. And one of the good things of late about Monday Night Raw, besides the Alexa Bliss stuff with The Fiend, I think she's been doing a bang-up job. The other thing is this budding on-screen relationship between Drew McIntyre and Sheamus. And they are furthering their story through, you know, each week on TV, through these different backstage segments, and now they're teaming up on TV. But I think they're doing so, unfortunately, they're doing so at the expense of making AJ Styles and his match with Drew McIntyre next Sunday, because we have a pay-per-view next Sunday. They're doing so at the risk of making that match just feel like a total and complete afterthought, which is what it feels like. They lost a handicap match on Monday night to AJ, Miz, and John Morrison when Sheamus accidentally gave Drew a brogue kick. Styles then caught Sheamus with the phenomenal forearm for the win. In the back after the match, both men came face to face. They said, you know what we have to do here. They went to break. They came back. And Drew and Sheamus were having a brawl in the back. And the officials and Pat Buck tried to get in between them to break them up. They ended up taking Pat Buck and they powerbombed him. They put him through a table. And then Drew and Sheamus, they kind of smiled and they looked at each other and they said, let's go get a pint. And they were best of friends again. So they're two buddies, they're two brawling buddies who sometimes fight. They're like two brothers who fight. Brothers fight, right? I used to fight all the time with my brother. It's fun. But it is so unlike WWE to have this storyline where the heel and the face are interacting with each other or are friendly with each other on screen. That's just not something that you usually see. And I like it. And I would like to see them hold off on the eventual match between the two of them as long as they possibly can. You know, I think if they don't do Roman Reigns and Drew McIntyre at WrestleMania, this could be your WWE Championship match on that show. And I don't think 2 or 3 months ago, if you told me, hey, what do you think about Sheamus being in the main event of WrestleMania, or one of the main events of WrestleMania, I don't think I would have been very enamored with that idea, because I don't think Sheamus was doing anything overly exciting at the time on TV. But it's amazing. All it takes sometimes is one story that is interesting in some way to get you to just completely, you know, turn the corner on somebody. And that's kind of how I feel about what they've been doing with Drew and Sheamus. And I just hope they don't blow it too soon. Randy Orton and Bray Wyatt had a match. Randy Orton and The Fiend are having a match next Sunday, but this was Randy Orton one-on-one against Funhouse Bray Wyatt. And Wyatt is out there. He's wearing black pants. He's got a brown sweater on. And he's got the dreads in his hair that normally you only see with The Fiend. Otherwise, he usually has his hair tied back, and he didn't here. And I thought that was a little strange, and it became very apparent why he looked the way he looked when we got to the end of this match. Orton gave him a back suplex on the announce desk. He hit a draping DDT when he was bringing him back into the ring. And now Orton is setting up for the finish. He is setting up for the RKO when all of a sudden the lights begin to flicker the way that it does before The Fiend comes out. So we knew The Fiend was coming. Orton says he didn't care. He hit the RKO anyway. And as he went for the pin, the lights went out completely. When the lights came back on, we had The Fiend sound effects and the fiend red lighting, it, you know, throughout the building. And they shot this perfectly. They shot this overhead shot of Randy Orton, who is on top of Bray Wyatt. He was going for the pin. I don't know why the referee stopped counting. But there's Orton. He's laying on top of Bray, but we can't see Bray's face. The camera pans out. Orton looks behind him, and he sees the Fiend. All of a sudden, he's got the Fiend mask on. He's in the Fiend striped outfit that he wears, you know, for his matches. He is laying on top of the Fiend, who does a zombie sit-up, and he puts the mandible claw on Randy Orton, and that is how the show goes off the air. So the sweater and the pants and all that was hiding the Fiend gear underneath. It was a little neat trick that was easy for them to pull off because they don't have any fans in the building. You know what it reminded me of? They did something like this at SummerSlam many years ago. At SummerSlam 2009, they had a TLC match with CM Punk and Jeff Hardy in the main event for the World Heavyweight title. And Punk wins, and Punk is standing over Jeff Hardy's broken body in the middle of the ring, and he's holding the title high up into the air, and all of a sudden, the Undertaker's gong goes off, and the lights go out. And when the lights come back on, Punk and everybody else, or not everybody, but a lot of the people are looking towards the aisleway, like, where's the Undertaker? And you could see a few fans in the crowd are pointing, like, look, 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 but a lot of people had no idea that when the lights went out, they did the old switcheroo, and it was Jeff Hardy who was laying beneath Punk's feet, but he had traded places with the Undertaker. So the Undertaker was already in the ring. He was laying there under Punk. Punk does the slow realization where he looks down and he sees the Undertaker is laying underneath him, and he does the zombie sit up and he grabs him by the throat, choke slam. It was a great spot. And that was in a building full of people. And they managed to pull that off pretty well. So that's kind of what this reminded me of. So, you know, they've done some stuff in this feud that I think has been, you know, kind of cool to watch. There was no Alexa Bliss on the show this week. So that was noticeable because, again, I think she's done a very good job with this stuff. I don't have high hopes for a match next week between Orton and The Fiend. And as far as predictions and all of that, I probably will do the TLC predictions on the YouTube channel a little bit later on in the week, maybe Thursday night. So I'll save my thoughts on all that if I do a stream then. But yeah, I don't have high hopes for an actual wrestling match between The Fiend and Randy Orton. Hopefully Alexa will be back and they've got something clever up their sleeve for what they might do. Hey, maybe Ramblin' Rabbit will do a run-in in the match. Maybe he'll cut a hole under the ring. Maybe Friendship Frog will come back to life. I saw they trademarked the name Friendship Frog. They're going to make Friendship Frog merchandise. Friendship Frog died in week one. And they're looking for ways to make money off Friendship Frog. So I don't think we've seen the end of him. SmackDown this week. This was the first Thunderdome show inside Tropicana Field. It looked no different than any of the other Thunderdome shows inside the Amway Center, save for the Pigeons, who I'm sure were watching from above. They're watching and they are waiting. They are waiting for the right moment to strike. This show was a bore fest. I thought SmackDown was just an absolute bore fest this week. Instead of waiting for TLC, they did the women's title match between Sasha Banks and Carmella on this show. Now, I figured because they're doing it on this show, there's going to be some kind of bullshit finish. That then leads to a rematch at the pay-per-view. Some kind of stipulation match ends up getting set up for TLC. I'm no wizard. This is just the way they do things. Dolph Ziggler beating Montez Ford, I guess, is supposed to get me to care about seeing Rudolph. Is that what they're calling themselves? I've seen a few people use that as their tag team name. Seems very appropriate for this time of year. Bobby Roode and Dolph Ziggler are Rudolph. I don't give a shit. I really don't. But he beat Montez Ford. He beat him. It was the same stuff they always do. Same formula they usually follow. And we're going to get a match for the tag team titles between the two of them at TLC. Can't wait. Sami Zayn outsmarted Big E and scored a count-out win by crawling underneath the ring. Big E followed him underneath. When Big E crawled out, or was trying to crawl after him. Sami Zayn came out the other side. He beat the count into the ring, and he got the count out win. The match was fine until the lame-ass finish. Kevin Owens was in the ring, standing on a ladder, talking about all of his friends. His friend Table, his friend Ladder, his friend Chair. I think Kevin Owens needs some new friends. Paul Heyman and Roman Reigns were in the back, watching on a screen. The correct way. Roman Reigns is one of the few who actually knows how to watch TV like a normal person in this company. Another reason to like this new and improved Roman Reigns. Jey Uso suddenly attacked Kevin Owens with a chair from behind, attacked the knee. So that may be an injury they play up now going into the TLC match at the pay-per-view. But Owens made his own comeback, and he ended up putting Jey Uso through a table. He powerbombed him through a table. Reigns and Heyman came out. Heyman talked him out of coming into the ring. He said, let's wait. Now is not the time. So they went to the back. So Kevin Owens gets to the back, and he's looking for them, and instead he finds Kayla Braxton, who wants to talk. And as he is talking to Kayla, Roman attacks him from behind, lays him out. Then he looked into the camera to address Kevin's family, to address his wife, to address his kids. He introduced himself as the head of the table. He said if they don't talk some sense into their daddy, he's going to have to take that food off their table. And he smiled and he walked off. I think he may have said, like, have a nice day or something as he walked off. He should have smiled and wished them a Merry Christmas and then walked off. That would have been even more dickish. But Roman Reigns, as usual, was the best part of the entire show. The Riot Squad, after making fun of Billie Kay on Talking Smack last week, beat Billie Kay and her tag team partner, Natalya, in a total throwaway match. So the creative geniuses in this company, let me see if I understand this. The creative geniuses in this company broke up the Iconics just to put Peyton Royce and Billie Kay on different shows in new makeshift tag teams. Now, they may not be permanent teams. I don't expect Peyton Royce to be a regular team necessarily with Lacey Evans, but in fact, we haven't even seen Peyton Royce on TV, I think, in a few weeks. Not on Raw. But when we did last month, she was usually in some kind of a tag team situation with Lacey Evans. Now Billie Kay is on SmackDown trying to find a tag team partner. I was no fan of the Iconics, but why even break them up in the first place if you were just going to do this? Why even break them up in the first place if you weren't going to go all in on a singles push for Peyton Royce? Billie Kay is nothing more than comedy fodder, and I think she could be good at that, but that's her role. I don't watch SmackDown to see a Billie Kay match. But I would like to see more of Peyton Royce in the ring. You know, that's a division that, frankly, could use someone like her to get over. But, you know, it just makes no sense. That was the purpose behind them breaking up the Iconics. And what have we seen? We've seen Peyton Royce with Lacey Evans. We've seen Billie Kay with Natalya. This is the brainchild of the creative forces within this company. I'm not impressed. Speaking of breaking up teams for no reason, we had Otis and Chad Gable losing to Shinsuke Nakamura and Cesaro. Otis had the advantage. Gable told him to tag out because they had a plan. So, tag me. And Cesaro ends up catching Gable in the giant swing into the Kinshasa by Nakamura. And so Cesaro and Nakamura get the win. Now, in the back after the match, Gable said that he asked to be tagged in, but he didn't really want to be tagged in. It was like he was testing Otis. He said Otis should have finished the match because he had the advantage. Gable said he was showing Otis what to do by showing him what not to do. Maybe that's why Vince McMahon books his television shows the way that he does. Maybe this is some warped way of showing the writers how to write a show by showing them the wrong way to write a show. Some kind of weird reverse psychology type of deal. It's worth noting that Chad Gable got his name back, yet he continues to lose. I at least think the stuff with him and Otis has some legs. I want to see where it goes. I like both of these guys. but he is still losing on TV. Baron Corbin, my favorite. Baron Corbin introduced Wesley Blake and Steve Cutler, who did not speak, but he formally introduced them in a backstage segment as the Knights of the Lone Wolf. So I guess that's what they're going to be called, the Knights of the Lone Wolf. Now, he did his promo in the back, thus avoiding being shit on by the pigeons of the Lone Wolf in the roof of the stadium. He can't hide back there forever, though. He's going to have to make his way out to the ring at some point. And when he does, they will be waiting. Sasha Banks and Carmella for the SmackDown Women's Championship ended with what else? A disqualification finish. Carmella has a new assistant, or at least for this week she did. This was portrayed by Akeem Young, NXT star Akeem Young. He was one of Timothy Thatcher's students many weeks ago in one of those Thatcher's Thatch Can segments on TV who got beat up. He brings her champagne now. He's Carmella's runner. He'll bring her champagne and whatever she asks for. He was out at ringside with the champagne on ice. And he pulled Sasha Banks at one point out of the ring. Sasha smacked him around. Then she got back inside and she stomped in the corner on Carmella until the referee called for the disqualification. The kicking too much ass finish in this main event here on SmackDown. Sasha put the assistant in the bank statement after the match until Carmella came over and kicked her in the head. Outside the ring, Carmella broke a bottle of champagne across Sasha's back and then celebrated by shaking up another bottle and spraying it on the announcers. They have to bridge the gap to WrestleMania with something for Sasha to do. And Carmella, she was as good as anybody else in, terms of finding somebody to put in that spot. But it's just not a program that I find very interesting. In fact, I think both of these women in this feud, they come off completely unlikable. I don't like either one of them. They come off as two of the most unlikable people on the entire roster. Sasha is just, she's such a natural heel. She really is. They have established that Carmella is the heel here after what she did. Clearly, Carmella is the one who is the heel. But I think Sasha, she can play either role depending on the opponent. So when we get to the point where we are getting closer to WrestleMania, and if they have any brains in their heads, it'll be Sasha Banks defending against Bianca Belair. She can play more of the heel role going into that match. You know, Sasha can be more heelish going into that match. I just think she's so much more comfortable and so much just more perfect in that role. But I don't see how you can find either one of these people likable. SmackDown has been generally an easier watch than Raw has been. And it still is. I can't in good conscience place SmackDown below Raw. But I just found this to be a very nothing episode. SmackDown, by the way, will be on FS1 this Friday. They are being bumped off of Fox because Fox will be airing a Pac-12 championship game. So a little programming note there. If you plan on watching SmackDown on Friday night, tune into FS1 and not Fox. Okay, it is December, which means that we can officially start watching Christmas movies. But what if you go to Netflix and you discover that your favorite Christmas movie is not available? Get ready to have your mind blown. You can use ExpressVPN and watch any Netflix library in the world. This weekend, I used ExpressVPN to stream a Christmas classic, Die Hard, on South Korean Netflix. It was so simple. I just opened up the app, hit one button to change my location, refresh Netflix, and that's it. See, ExpressVPN lets you control where you want sites to think that you're located. You can choose from almost 100 countries, so just imagine all the Netflix libraries that you can explore. And of course, it's not just Netflix. ExpressVPN works with any streaming service. Disney Plus, Hulu, BBC iPlayer, you name it. There are hundreds of VPNs out there, but the reason that I use ExpressVPN to watch movies and shows is because it is ridiculously fast. There's never any buffering. You can always stream in HD. ExpressVPN works with all of your devices too, including phones, tablets, media consoles, smart TVs, so you can use it to watch whatever you want, on the go or on the big screen. If you visit my special link right now, expressvpn.com/solomonster, you can get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. Support the show, watch what you want, and get your holiday fix at expressvpn.com/solomonster. So there's a lot to unpack here with all the AEW news, AEW and Impact. I talked a little bit about this on the Wednesday night stream, but Impact last week was the real beneficiary from this working relationship that the two promotions seemed to have. The hope was that by having Kenny Omega and Don Callis make a special appearance together on Impact, that it would boost their viewership. And it did. In fact, their previous record on Twitch was 17,000, and they peaked while Omega was on the show. On Twitch, they peaked with over 52,000 viewers. On Access TV, the show had 221,000 viewers, which was up from 166,000 the week before. And I know that Impact put out a press release talking about total viewership and engagement, including YouTube and clips on social media, was something like 750,000. You know, yeah, if you put everything together, then of course, I mean, if you do that with WWE, then they would probably have 3 or 4 million. But even still, it was very impressive. And if you are a fan of Impact, if you are an employee of Impact, if you are Don Callis or if you are Scott D'Amore, you have to be very happy with how things turned out because it got more eyeballs on their product. Now, did people like what they saw? They're going to stick around and tune in again this week? Because I don't see Impact getting 221,000 viewers again on Access. But even if they come close to that, if they picked up some new fans, then it's a net gain for them. Now, I didn't watch the entire show. I saw the paid advertisement that was inserted into the show with Tony Schiavone and Tony Khan. And I liked it. I thought it was very clever. Tony Khan is there basically playing low-key heel persona who's being very snarky and saying, you know, I wanted to take out this ad because I want to help out Impact by paying for this ad. I'm sure they can use the money. It helps their budget. So clearly he was doing a take off what Vince McMahon did many years ago. That's how it came off to me. And I said this on Wednesday night. What Vince McMahon did in the Memphis territory in the USWA back in 1993. The big difference being that back then there was no YouTube, there was no social media outside of, I guess, RSPW. And by the way, great plug. Brand new RSPW Rewind just went up the other day. So if you missed it, go check it out. But that was about the only form of social media wrestling-wise that would have existed back then. People didn't know. If you were a WWF fan watching in the Northeast, you had no idea that Vince McMahon was on television in Memphis playing heel, and Randy Savage and Bret Hart and Tatanka and all these people were playing heel on Memphis television. But, you know, Vince agreed to do it as a favor to Jerry Lawler, and I think he enjoyed himself. You go back on YouTube and watch some of these old Vince McMahon clips, he's having a blast, and it was really the earliest incarnation of the Mr. McMahon character that you can find. And this, I think, was Tony Khan's way of almost trying to do the same thing. Tony Schiavone was great. He was just there. He didn't have much to say, but he did make the comment at one point. He goes, yeah, you know, I was in Impact many, many years ago. I spent one night there, and I quit the wrestling business for 18 years after that. So they were taking little subtle digs. And I thought it was well done. If we continue to see stuff like that, I would like to see it. I enjoyed it. What I don't need to see is Tony Khan becoming a regular character on AEW television. But if he did these pop-in appearances on Impact, playing that character, that sort of money mark promoter character that he came across as in this ad, I think that could be a lot of fun. So I thought that was well done. They had a segment where Rich Swann, who was the Impact Wrestling World Champion, he retained his title at the Impact pay-per-view last night. He was trying to get into the parking lot, and the security guard stopped him and said, "This is reserved for the champion only." And that champion was not Rich Swann, that champion was Kenny Omega. Rich Swann was not happy about that, So they are already planting the seeds for a potential match between Rich Swann and Kenny Omega. And then they had Josh Matthews on the tour bus with Kenny and with Don Callis. And Callis tried to talk this up like this. Everything that's happened was all part of this grand master plan that was hatched years and years and years ago. He said, you know, I'm the one that got that match booked at Wrestle Kingdom a few years ago, which is true, between Chris Jericho and Kenny Omega. Tony Khan has made the comment before that that match was sort of the beginnings of what would lead to AEW. And so therefore, if you look at it like that, by Tony Khan's own admission, Don Callis says that we are responsible for the genesis of All Elite Wrestling. All of this is because of us. And Callis and Omega together are great. It's like their own little version of Lesnar and Heyman, and, you know, only if Lesnar talked more. Lesnar doesn't usually have much to say. He usually leaves the talking to Paul Heyman. But I like the dynamic between these two. I like the idea of Don Callis going forward, which he is going to be the manager. He's going to be full-time with Kenny Omega. I like it. I like the pairing. I like this segment. Kenny Omega was teasing the fact that he wants to become a collector of different championships. And I said on the Dynamite stream that it strikes me, depending on how far they go with this, are we going to see Kenny Omega, for example, appearing for different promotions, winning their title? He retained his AAA Mega title at Triple Mania last night, so he has that title. He's got the AEW World title. They're already planting the seeds for a possible match, maybe for the Impact World title, between Rich Swann and Kenny Omega. Kenny Omega could end up being the Impact Wrestling World Champion. And if I'm Impact, I keep this going as long as I can. Because they're the ones who are really going to end up benefiting the longer that this goes on. Impact has nothing to lose here. So if they have an opportunity to put their world title on Kenny Omega, who's going to walk out on TNT with that belt every week, then I do it. I mean, hey, I all due respect to Rich Swann, Kenny Omega being the Impact World Champion would be a bigger deal. Or Impact might look at it and go, we want to use Kenny Omega in a possible match to get our guys over. So he would lose. Omega would lose to Rich Swann. Kenny Omega should not be losing to anybody. Kenny Omega should be collecting as much hardware as he can. Kenny Omega has effectively taken the role that, in some ways, Nick Aldis kind of had. Nick Aldis was trying to be that traveling world champion, like the old school NWA champion, and the pandemic just completely ruined all of that. You haven't even heard his name mentioned much at all recently, and he's certainly not able to go around and travel around to all these shows like he was doing before. It feels almost to me like Kenny Omega is kind of taking the role that Nick Aldis had, or Nick Aldis had hoped to have. But I think it's great, and I'd like to see them go all the way with it and let him win a few different championships. And then I started fantasy booking this out in my head on Wednesday night on the stream, and I said, you know, Kenny Omega's going to go around and start winning all these titles. You've got Wrestle Kingdom coming up next month, and Kota Ibushi could very well walk out as the new IWGP champion. And then what happens then? If there's the possibility of some sort of working agreement between those two companies in 2021, and you've got Kenny as the champion, you've got Kota as the champion, I mean, come on. How do you not start kind of fantasy booking out some of these different scenarios? And it's pretty cool stuff. I'm enjoying what they're doing, and we'll see where it goes. Impact has confirmed that Kenny Omega is going to be appearing again this Tuesday on Impact. And there are some reports suggesting that he is going to headline at least one Impact pay-per-view, you know, likely against Rich Swann. He was on the pay-per-view last night, hanging out on the bus with Carl Anderson, teasing maybe some sort of Bullet Club reunion of some kind. Now, I said that I didn't think AEW would break a million live viewers on TNT this past week, and I was right. But if you want to really quibble about it, they only missed the mark by 5,000 viewers. It really doesn't get too much closer than that. 995,000 live viewers, the most ever, head-to-head with NXT. They've broken a million before, but usually it's unopposed. I'm pretty sure this was their highest combined audience number on a night where they were head-to-head with NXT, 995,000. Some people are going to look at that and be disappointed they didn't break a million. I didn't expect them to break a million. So I look at that number and I say, that's pretty good. Even better, they crushed it in the key demo. Number two. I couldn't believe it when I looked at the chart and AEW was in the number two spot. 18 to 49, males 18 to 49 for that night on all of cable. There was one MTV show that beat them out. Otherwise, AEW would have been in the number one spot. They were number one by a large margin on all of cable in men, 18 to 49. NXT finished the night with 659,000 live viewers on USA. Both shows, and here's the bigger news, both shows combined for their highest audience since February. And that is news that I like to see. Sting and Shaq made appearances on Dynamite on Wednesday. Their quarter hours both did over a million viewers. Actually, there were four quarters on AEW that did over a million viewers. It wasn't just Sting and Shaq. There were four of them that broke a million. And yeah, the Shaq thing just came off to me as a waste. Now we have to see if it's actually going to lead to more Shaq appearances on TV. I really don't have any interest in seeing Shaq step into the ring, but the segment they did was a pre-taped studio segment. Tony Schiavone was hosting. It was Brandi Rhodes and Shaquille O'Neal. And it ended with Brandi throwing water on Shaq and calling him an overgrown asshole because Shaq was talking about Jade Cargill, the woman who broke Brandy's arm recently. Brandi came across in this segment like a total heel. But yet, Jade is the one, I think, who's supposed to be the heel. Jade's the one who broke her arm a few weeks ago. I don't know who is supposed to be the one that we're rooting for and who's the one that we're not rooting for. I'm very confused. But if this were to lead to a mixed tag team match on TV, I guess you could do it on pay-per-view, but let's say on an episode of Dynamite, they did Cody and Brandi against Shaq and Jade. I mean, it would pop a big number. There's no doubt about it. I mean, it would be an attraction to do one time, and Shaq wouldn't have to do much. But then again, Jade Cargill, she's very inexperienced. So you can't necessarily rely on her to really lead the way in a match like that. I don't know what that match would look like, but just seeing those four in the ring together, seeing Shaq standing there in the ring or standing on the apron, as a one-night thing, yeah, I'm sure it would probably pop a huge number. But I just thought the segment they did on Wednesday, it just came across like they were using Shaq to just get Brandi Rhodes over. And we'll have to see if he's going to come back for anything beyond that. Santana was MIA during the Inner Circle segment where they teased that they might break up. Of course, they didn't. Santana was not there. He lost his stepfather this past week. This is after losing his father earlier this year. So he lost two fathers in 1 year. That's rough. And Pentagon was dealing with a legitimate leg injury, which is why he was bounced early from the six-man tag match on Dynamite. They had the Butcher powerbomb him. Well, suplex, not powerbomb. He suplexed him through a table. He was, you know, selling a leg injury and taking off. We never saw Penta again. Penta was back in the ring with Phoenix, I guess defending their AAA tag team titles at Triple Mania last night. So obviously the injury can't be that serious. But it was a legitimate injury. When we were talking about it on the stream on Wednesday, I wasn't sure if it was just a worked injury because they wanted to turn it into a handicap match. But they got him out of there early because I guess in training, it wasn't even in a match. He was training, he was exercising, whatever he was doing, and he suffered some kind of a leg injury that, again, I presume is not all that serious. This Wednesday on Dynamite, Kenny Omega meets Joey Janela in a world title eliminator match, the one that was supposed to take place in the eliminator tournament before Full Gear, and then Janela got pulled from the match due to a possible COVID exposure. Sonny Kiss took his place. Kenny beat Sonny Kiss in about 10 seconds. This time it's going to be no disqualification. Anything goes. And if Joey Janela wins, he earns a future world title match. Now, this is after Omega vanity searched his name on social media, and he was stunned to learn that a lot of people don't like him and don't think he is worthy of being the champion. They think he backdoored into the finals of that tournament and then went on to win the world title in not the cleanest fashion. So the storyline is that he is giving Joey Janela one shot. And if he's worried about Kenny using a microphone like he did on Jon Moxley or anything like that, no problem. He says, we can make it a hardcore match. He goes, I'm going to be just fine using my skill. You want to use weapons and stuff? Go ahead. I'm going to use my skill here in this match. Cody Rhodes goes one-on-one with Angelico. Matt Hardy and Private Party. I guess Hardy Party, is that what they call themselves? They take on Hangman Page, who has agreed for 1 week to team up with the Dark Order, Alex Reynolds, and John Silver. SCU takes on the Acclaimed, the new team of Max Castor and Anthony Bowens. Ivelisse and Diamante take on Serena Deeb and Big Swole. Now, some special shows coming up. They announced a Holiday Bash show on December 23rd. That is going to be airing late. There is an NBA game on TNT that night. So either at 10 p.m. or whenever the basketball game is over, that is when Dynamite will go on the air. So we'll have to play it by ear if I go live that night on YouTube. I don't feel like going live on YouTube at midnight. We'll have to play that one by ear and see what happens. But that is 2 days before Christmas. And then they have a two-part special event. December 30th is night one of AEW New Year's Smash. January 6th is night two of New Year's Smash. Special appearance by Snoop Dogg, who appears on that Go Big show. He's one of the judges on that show with Cody. So this is probably a Turner thing where, you know, just like Shaq being on Dynamite. Shaq works for Turner. Yeah, we'll let Shaq make a cameo on the show. Snoop Dogg, he's going to be on this new TBS show. And so he's going to be appearing on Dynamite. Apparently there are people in WWE who are said to not be very happy about the fact that Snoop Dogg is going to be on Dynamite. This Dynamite show is running opposite NXT's New Year's Evil special, which I'm going to talk about here in a second. But people in WWE are not very happy. And I can believe that. All you got to do is go listen to Kevin Smith. It might have been the very first episode of Dynamite. Remember that week? Dynamite debuted the same week that Fox premiered SmackDown. And Kevin Smith and Jason Mewes, I guess, were promoting their new Jay and Silent Bob movie. I guess that came out around the same time. But they appeared on Dynamite, and I think they were supposed to appear on SmackDown, and then they were told that they were pulled because they appeared on the AEW show. So if you don't think that there is a level of pettiness involved here, that it could have worked out like this, then you're not paying attention. I 100% believe that there are people in WWE who are pissed and feel somehow betrayed or blindsided that Snoop Dogg is going to be appearing on AEW. Now, he had that clothing line with The Undertaker. Apparently, all that merch just got pulled. I don't think that has to do with this. I think that was a limited run. But there were people who saw that and said, oh, look at that. What a coincidence. They just pulled all the Snoop Undertaker stuff. I don't know that that has anything to do with this. But again, I wouldn't be surprised to find out if it did. Because these people are petty. These are petty, petty people. Tom Petty is their favorite musician. That's just how they roll. That's how they are. But Snoop Dogg is apparently going to be doing commentary on Dynamite. So they're trying to replicate, I guess, what he did on that recent pay-per-view, the Mike Tyson, Roy Jones Jr. pay-per-view, where he was doing commentary with Mauro Ranallo. And I actually thought he was very entertaining. It was just, I was entertained by his commentary. And I thought he just reminded me of somebody who was a fan in his living room, just cussing up a storm, watching a fight. But if you put a microphone in front of that person, it would sound like Snoop Dogg. So they're going to try to replicate that by having him do commentary on Dynamite. Now, Jim Ross made some comments on his Grilling JR podcast episode this week. They covered Armageddon 2000. But he made comments on that show that apparently have rubbed some members of the AEW roster the wrong way. JR was asked if moves like the super kick and the DDT should be protected, or if their current usage in wrestling is simply an evolution of the business. This is what JR said. That evolution of the business stuff is bullshit. Yes, they should be protected. The DDT is a finish. The superkick is just part of the flow now of a match. Nobody wins with it. What does that say to you? Does that say guys in, you know, back in the day were more proficient in delivering a DDT or a superkick than in this generation where things are quote-unquote evolving? I want some proof of that shit. I want somebody to prove to me that changing of the wrestling business is what it is today and it's making a difference. I say no. I told a kid the other day at AEW that everybody does the same fucking spot. All you guys go outside, you cluster up like coils, you stand there in a huddle, friends and foes together side by side, so you can catch some leaping idiot going out over the top rope who never wins with this move. They are looking for the holy shit chant. They love to hear, this is awesome. It's a spot, folks. It is a trapeze act. I don't buy into that. The DDT is a great finish and should be used as such. WrestlingNews.co reached out to a couple of AEW wrestlers, and they report that while they think JR makes some good points, they don't like him ripping on their work in public. One wrestler had this to say, "Look, I know there is a lot that JR can teach us, but burying us on the show or on his podcast is only going to make some of us ignore what he says. I grew up watching JR, and he is the best, and we love it that he calls our matches, but maybe find a different way to criticize the wrestlers in the ring. Everyone is doing what they have been taught. I agree that sometimes things need to be slowed down, but that will not happen when a guy who is supposed to help out or help put us over is going out there and publicly burying us." And I saw Brandon Cutler from AEW. He went on Twitter to hype up his match on Dynamite. There's, I think, some kind of 14-man, 7-on-7 tag match. I guess he's in it. And he was kind of needling at the JR comments. He said, "We're going to go outside, cluster up like coils, stand there in a huddle, friends and foes together, side by side, to catch some leaping idiot going over the top. Can't wait. 8 p.m. TNT. Jim Ross is 100% right in every single thing that he said. The DDT should be protected. The superkick is too far gone. The superkick will never again be a finish the way it was for Shawn Michaels. It is just, it has been abused so much that it would take an unbelievable re-education of the audience, I think, to get them to buy into one superkick being able to be a finish. I mean, I guess it's possible, but to me, the superkick, you can dial it back, but it is too far gone. The DDT, I think, can be protected and used again as a finish. I mean, DDTs, destroyers, that to me... And I'm surprised he didn't bring that up. But I guess he's thinking more old school, right? Superkick and DDT were moves that he saw people using 20 or 30 years ago. You didn't see people doing destroyers 25 years ago. That's still a relatively, at least in terms of North American wrestling, that's still a relatively new thing. That to me is one of the most egregious examples. How many times we see people using the destroyer on TV and it's not even a move that, I mean, it barely gets a near fall. Sometimes they don't even follow it up with a near fall. It's just a transition spot in a match. And I go on and on about how bullshit that is. So I agree 100% with where JR is coming from on that stuff. The guys clustering together and standing there like idiots to catch people on dives, as often as we see it, it is bullshit. It is bullshit. And this is not just an AEW problem. This is a wrestling problem. I was struck by that quote from the anonymous AEW wrestler. "Everyone is doing what they have been taught," is what this person says. Therein lies the problem. This is how they're teaching these people now. This is how these kids are being taught. They're teaching them the dives. They're teaching them these dumb spots. And then they think, well, this is just what you do in a wrestling match. And they'll say, wrestling has evolved. Wrestling has devolved because of stuff like that. There is a time and a place. I'm not saying just complete banishment. There is a time and a place to do that stuff. Now they use it so much that it doesn't mean anything. Jim Ross said absolutely nothing wrong. I do think he needs to stop criticizing the spots during the shows, like right after they happen. You've heard me talk about that from day one. I've made comments before about JR burying the show during the show. And I think he does less of that now. I will agree on that. That is not the time or the place to be doing that. I think that is a fair criticism. And I've called him out for that before. When you are in the middle of calling matches on live TV, you know, to take little digs at the moves, that does not do anybody any good. But him talking about stuff like this publicly on his podcast, or him giving an interview to a news outlet and commenting on it publicly, I see nothing wrong with that. I think that's fair game. And I think he is absolutely dead on in that criticism. Finn Balor was back on NXT this week, and he was in the opening segment interrupted by Pete Dunne, who was interrupted by Kyle O'Reilly. This was the parade of challengers and some of the bad dialogue that you would find in like a really bad opening segment on Monday Night Raw. That is not a good thing. They should not be doing segments like this on NXT. And then Damian Priest came out and he interrupted. I was not really a fan of any of this, except Damian Priest was interrupted himself by Scarlett, because we know Karrion Kross was on his way back, right? We knew that based on the tease at TakeOver. And so he addressed Scarlett, called her, hey, Smoke Show, which used to be what, you know, she was called pre-WWE. And he made a dig at Karrion Kross, you know, something along the lines of, you know, your guy, is he out in the car when you're, you know, in here? And she made a face like, okay, you just basically sealed your fate. You just made a big mistake, buddy. And boy, did he ever. He would come to regret that comment a little bit later on in the show. But not much else really to the segment. I mean, it set things up for the match that's going to be coming up next week on the show, when they're going to be determining a number one contender for the NXT Championship. I just didn't like the layout of this segment and some of the dialogue. It just came off as just not the sort of thing that we are used to seeing on NXT. Keep that crap on Raw. I don't even want to see it on Raw, but keep it on Raw. We don't need opening segments like this on NXT. Tommaso Ciampa pinned Cameron Grimes while Timothy Thatcher watched from ringside. So this program is going to continue. What I had said when I did the predictions for TakeOver was I had predicted that Ciampa would win, which he did, but I was kind of hoping that they would bring it back to a rematch and make it a fight pit match. And, you know, the fight pit should be a Thatcher specialty. And then Thatcher could get a big win because he needs it. Ciampa needed a big TakeOver win too, but Thatcher, he loses far more often than he should. And I'm hoping that the end result here is going to be a Thatcher win, and it could be in a fight pit match. So they are keeping this feud continuing. We had another segment with Xia Li and Boa being abused. They were being tortured in training somewhere. The way they shot this segment, and really the way they've shot a lot of these segments, it comes off like something you would see out of a trailer for a new TV show or a movie on Netflix or something. I mean, it really is well done. It's well shot. I have no idea what's going on, other than there's obviously this woman who is sort of, you know, leading the way on all of this. You have the old Asian guy, the Shifu, I guess they call him, which is Master. And he's obviously doing all of this at the request of this woman. We don't know who this woman is. I know some people keep telling me, oh, it's Mako Satomura, and, you know, she's working for WWE again. Mako Satomura, I think, has an agreement where she's doing something with NXT UK. I also don't think Mako Satomura is Chinese, so if people get into the whole thing of, well, they all look alike. No, I mean, it's not exactly the same thing. I don't think it's Mako. I think it's probably just a vehicle to get Karen Q And I said this weeks ago, Karen Q was doing some tag matches with Xia Li. Karen Q last year broke her leg. It was a very serious injury. She's about ready to come back, I believe, and it could be a vehicle to get her back on TV. All we see are little glimpses of this woman's eyes, and we see like her nails. They don't show you her face. They haven't done the big reveal yet, but these two were being abused. They had, you know, they were being beaten with a kendo stick, and Xia Li was punching something, and she had bloody knuckles, and they kept saying, faster, faster, you gotta keep doing it, and it's pretty brutal stuff. Boa looked like he was getting the shit beaten out of him. He had blood coming out of his mouth. He was being whipped across the back with the sticks. So I dig these segments. I don't know exactly where it's leading, but it is one of those things on this show that has me very intrigued. I actually look forward to seeing what these segments are going to be every single week. Johnny Gargano, Candice LeRae, Austin Theory, and Indy Hartwell are now calling themselves The Way. Wasn't that a song many years ago? What was that band, Fastball? Is that what they called themselves? That was their big song, their big hit, probably one-hit wonders, The Way. If you're not in the way, stay out of our way. That was the quote that Candice LeRae used during this segment. I liked the interaction here with them. I think it's a great spot for Austin Theory to be in. He came off as this almost like a goofy sidekick. I don't know that I would go too goofy with him, but I do think it's a good spot for him to be in. Indy Hartwell's out there with a neck brace on. I don't know why she still has the neck brace on, but she still has the neck brace on. And Gargano was just his smarmy heel self, and I think he's really eating it up. I think he loves this role. He's embracing it. I find it entertaining. So I'm digging it so far. It's only 1 week. Damian Priest interrupted. And they wanted you to think, I guess, that Damian Priest was still going to go after the North American Championship. Clearly, that is not the case. They appear to be moving him away to a different program, and that program is with Karrion Kross, because Karrion Kross, after his little comment earlier in the show, attacked Damian Priest and ended up powerbombing him onto a table that was positioned right on the side of the stage. And then the camera followed Kross as he walked back out of the building and into the car, which, you know, there's Scarlett in the passenger seat. And he drove off. He came across like a total badass here. Did Karrion Kross. Pete Dunne beat Killian Dane, who was back. Last time we saw Killian Dane, the Kings of NXT, Pat McAfee's group, slammed a car door on his head. He wasn't very happy about that. I mean, look, if somebody slammed a car door on your head, I don't think you would be too enamored with them either. So he wanted a piece of Pete Dunne. They had a match. Pete Dunne got the win, with an assist from Oney Lorcan and Danny Burch. No Pat McAfee on the show. I know he's selling the injuries from the War Games match. I do wonder how much we're going to see him on TV, though, going forward. So are we not going to see him at all? Are we going to see him full-time? I don't know. I hope we'll see him, because he's been one of the best parts of NXT. I think this group dies a death without him. You got to have him on the show. But he's selling the injury, as he should be. He's selling the injuries from the war. Especially, he's not a wrestler. You put a non-wrestler in a War Games match, and he gets the hell beaten out of him. It would be very WWE-like to have him back on TV that week. NXT, they do things a little bit different. Even though it is still technically WWE. We have learned that, obviously, Vince McMahon really is completely divorced from NXT. That much is apparent. So in NXT, they actually do things in a little bit more of a sensible way. Raquel Gonzalez in the main event. Pretty good match. Got a win over Ember Moon. They are keeping this woman strong. She got the pin on the NXT Women's Champion in the War Games match. She pinned Io Shirai. Here she pinned Ember Moon. And she is well on her way to getting a shot at the NXT Women's Championship. I would make the switch. I would do a title change when these two get in the ring together. This Wednesday, it's Johnny Gargano and Austin Theory taking on Leon Ruff and Kushida, who offered to take the place of Damian Priest after the attack by Karrion Kross. So it looks like Kushida has been protected, not for an NXT championship match, but for an NXT North American championship match with Johnny Gargano. Rhea Ripley takes on Toni Storm this Wednesday. Pete Dunne wrestles Kyle O'Reilly. The winner will meet Finn Balor for the NXT championship at the New Year's Evil show on January 6th. So here's what I'm thinking. Here's how things are looking for NXT as we head into the new year. And as we head into the New Year's Evil show on January 6th. Balor against Pete Dunne. I think it's got to be Pete Dunne getting the win. Kyle O'Reilly already wrestled Balor anyway at TakeOver. It seems pretty obvious that Pete Dunne is going to get the win. So I think we're looking at Balor and Dunne for the NXT championship, which is amazing. It's the match I've been waiting to see. Io Shirai defends her women's championship, I would think, against Raquel Gonzalez. Kushida, probably next in line to challenge Johnny Gargano for the NXT North American title. Damian Priest has a match waiting with Karrion Kross. And the issue with Ciampa and Thatcher, that's continuing. Maybe a fight pit match? Maybe not. And I am genuinely intrigued by the stuff with Boa and Xia Li to see what the big reveal ends up being out of this whole thing. Probably leading to a Karen Q return. NXT has all of its key stuff primed and set up and ready to go. Heading into the new year. And that's shaping up to be a pretty strong show on January 6th. You're going to have to make a choice. You either watch all of this live or you watch Snoop Dogg over on TNT doing commentary. Choices. We all have choices in life. DVR makes those choices a lot easier now. But what side do you fall on? What are you going to be watching on January 6th?
History has been made here!
This week in wrestling history, we begin all the way back 49 years ago this week. On December 13th, 1971, a most important date in Japanese wrestling history, WWE Hall of Famer Antonio Inoki was fired from the Japan Wrestling Association after a failed coup to take over the promotion with Giant Baba. The only reason Baba wasn't fired was because he was their top star at the time, so Inoki took the fall. The following year, Inoki founded a new promotion of his own called New Japan Pro Wrestling. In that same year, Baba left the JWA to form All Japan Pro Wrestling. Both companies are still going today. The JWA, meanwhile, without its two biggest names, it didn't really stand a chance, and they folded in 1973. 34 years ago this week, on December 13th, 1986, in a match in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, pitting the British Bulldogs against Don Morocco and Cowboy Bob Orton, Dynamite Kid suffered a nearly career-ending back injury. He did come back from it, but he was never the same again after this. I mean, this was, it's almost like BCAD in terms of the tale of two careers. The Dynamite Kid, as people knew him and remembered him, that kind of performer, he basically died on this day. He was never the same after this. Watching the fan cam footage, there just so happened to be a fan filming, and this was in 1986, and at some live event, and this fan happened to be filming. So if you look around on YouTube, you can find the fan cam footage. The footage of the spot where the injury happened, it's hardly some kind of big bump that Dynamite Kid took. His body just gave out after years of abuse. He wrestled a very, very hard in-ring style. Being roided up, I'm sure, to the gills didn't help. I'm sure that contributed to the breakdown of his body. But he hit the ropes, and he took a knee to the back by Don Morocco on the apron. Morocco just kind of lifted his knee up, referee didn't see it, and he crumbled to the mat, but it wasn't the knee that did it. He wrote in his book that he was in mid-stride jumping over Orton to go hit the ropes, and as soon as he jumped in the air mid-stride, so he didn't even hit the ropes yet, he felt something in his back just go. And nobody realized how hurt he was. He managed to tag out to Davey Boy Smith. He spent the rest of the match laying on the apron. He had to be stretchered out of the building. Had surgery to repair two torn lumbar discs in his back. And he ended up with really bad nerve damage. He wrestled on for a few years. I think up until 91. Didn't wrestle again, I don't think, until 1996. And you find footage of that tag match that he was part of in 96 and how much smaller he looks. It's really, really striking. But he wrestled his last match in 96 and he spent the rest of his life in a wheelchair. 32 years ago, on December 13th, 1988, the AWA held its one and only pay-per-view as an interpromotional event with World Class, called Super Clash 3, two promotions that were near death and were definitely off their peak from many years earlier, working together. They only drew about 1,600 people live in the building, had about 40,000 buys on pay-per-view. The show featured a title unification match between Jerry Lawler as the AWA World Champion and Kerry Von Erich as the World Class Champion. And there's a couple of interesting stories to this. The match ended by ref stoppage, with Lawler unifying titles due to excessive blood loss by Von Erich. Before the match, in the back, and I think, and Lawler talked about this, I think, in his book and also on his podcast. The plan was for the stoppage to come due to a cut on Kerry's forehead. So Kerry would cut himself, and there would be so much blood that the referee would just have no choice but to stop the match. So Kerry taped a blade to his finger to use late in the match. And a lot of wrestlers did that. They would tape the blade either to their finger, they would keep it in their mouth, which always freaked me out when I heard that, or they would tape it in their wrist tape. And there's actually video from a video that Jimmy Garvin shot backstage at some of the Great American Bash shows that WCW, or I guess NWA, did. Might have been the Great American Bash 88. But he took a whole series of home movies that eventually he put out online. And it's the craziest thing, because this is back in like prime 1980s. And he's walking around in the locker room, and they're all sitting around getting ready for their match. And there's Sting, and there's Luger, and of course Hawk and Animal are just being all nutty. Well, Hawk is being nutty. But you get to see these guys in their prime sitting there taping the blade, and they're showing you, okay, here's where I put it. And so anyway, that was commonplace. That's how they did it. And in this case, Kerry decided to tape the blade to his finger. While he was in the dressing room, though, this is before the match, right? They're getting ready. He's in the dressing room. He forgot. He was a little absent-minded, which I guess Kerry Von Erich was known to be for what, you know, various reasons. And he just forgot himself for a second, forgot that he had a blade taped to his index finger. He went to go scratch himself under the arm. It's a good thing his eye didn't itch. Or he wasn't reaching for a booger up his nose. But he had an itch under his arm, and he went to go scratch himself, and when he did, he sliced his bicep, like, deep. This was not like a paper cut. He sliced his bicep open under the arm, and he started, and blood started shooting out. Lawler said blood was shooting out like crazy. There wasn't enough time to get the wound closed. They tried to put tape on it, but he had to get out there. They had a match to do. So in the first 60 seconds of the match, Lawler grabs Kerry by the arm, and he sort of rams the arm into the top turnbuckle, just as a way that they could explain why his arm was bleeding, why his arm had a gash on it, which the announcers acknowledged. On TV the following week, Kerry said that he was cut by a Jerry Lawler fan with a knife on his way to the ring, which is why his arm was bleeding. That he just said that as a way to cover for it. No such knifing took place, other than the one Kerry gave himself. But the other thing that happened, one of many stories of Vince McMahon playing dirty, which makes me laugh every time I think about him whining about billionaire Ted in the 90s. This is from the December 19, 1988 issue of the Wrestling Observer. Allegedly, Vince McMahon tried to get the match canceled by alerting the state commission in the state of Illinois that there was an amputee wrestling on the show. In the state of Illinois at the time, there was some obscure rule on the books that no one with any artificial limbs could compete in any kind of, I guess, competition in the state. And it was an open secret at that point that Kerry had lost his foot in a motorcycle accident. Even though he never admitted it publicly, certainly not up to that point, he wanted to keep that under wraps. And I think Bill Apter, he had promised Bill Apter to, I think, take a picture that night in the back at some point of his foot or whatever, and Kerry kept dodging him and putting him off and putting him off. And then finally, Kerry just said to him, look, just tell them that you saw it and the foot looked fine. Like, he just did not want to come out with it. So people knew, but they didn't know. Certainly the public didn't know. I didn't know when I was watching the Texas Tornado, you know, when I was in my young wrestling fandom. I had no idea that he had lost his foot. Vince McMahon knew. And so he tried to get the match canceled. Vince tipped off the commission. The commission then scheduled a hearing for the day after the pay-per-view, which Vince apparently was furious about. So he went to court to try to get the hearing rescheduled to a few days before the show. Kerry happened to be on tour at that time in Japan, so he couldn't be there. So the commission, who, and I think the commission knew what was going on here. I don't think these people are stupid. I think they knew what he was trying to do. So, you know, he's trying to cause mischief. And they were probably fed up with his shit. So they ruled that wrestling was fake, the rule did not apply, and they said that even if it was a legitimate competition, they have the power to grant exceptions, and they likely would be granting one in this case anyway. And so since he obviously wasn't going to get what he wanted, McMahon just dropped the whole issue, and that was that. And it's interesting that when he signed Kerry a few years later to come to the WWF, I'm sure that Kerry must have wrestled in the state of Illinois a few times, right? Probably some Chicago shows for WWF. Funny, I don't think Vince McMahon raised the issue then of him being an amputee. See, ruthless aggression was not just a catchphrase that he came up with years later. It was a lifestyle for Vince McMahon back in the 80s. 31 years ago this week, on December 12th, 1989, at a TV taping in Nashville, Tennessee, WWE taped No Holds Barred, The Match, The Movie, which was a double billing that aired on pay-per-view right after Christmas, where they aired the movie first, followed by the match inside a steel cage, pitting Hulk Hogan and Brutus the Barber Beefcake against Zeus and the Macho King. And it was the final appearance that Zeus would make in the WWF. If you want to watch the match, it's only about 10 minutes long. It's a relatively short match. You can find it, though, on the WWE Network. It is at the, I think, the end of Super Tape Volume 1, which is under the Coliseum Video or the Home Video section on the network. I think it's the first Super Tape, because there are a whole bunch of Super Tapes, and I'm pretty sure it's on there at the end. So if you want to watch it, that's the place you can go find it. 23 years ago this week, on December 7th, 1997, WWE held its Degeneration X In Your House pay-per-view, and on this night, Triple H beat then-Commissioner Sergeant Slaughter in a boot camp match, and he needed help from China to do. How pathetic. How pathetic. Triple H needed help from a woman to beat almost 50-year-old Sergeant Slaughter. But I guess that's how heels get heat in WWE. So Triple H won the boot camp match. Jeff Jarrett got a disqualification win over The Undertaker when Kane interfered and he gave old Double J a chokeslam. I had completely forgotten that this match even happened, but it will go down in the record books as a pay-per-view win for Jeff Jarrett over The Undertaker. Shawn Michaels retained his WWE title over Ken Shamrock in the main event by DQ. After the match, Owen Hart returned. For the first time since the Montreal Screwjob, he attacked Shawn Michaels. Owen had wanted to leave and join his brother and join the British Bulldog, who bought himself out of his own contract. He wanted to go join them in WCW. Vince McMahon would not let him leave. Owen was the one heart that Vince McMahon would not let him out of his contract. But that should have been the title match at the Royal Rumble in 98. Instead, they blew off the match between Shawn Michaels and Owen Hart on TV a few weeks later because I guess Vince McMahon wasn't quite done fucking over members of the Hart family. Also on this show, Stone Cold Steve Austin, he retained his Intercontinental title over The Rock, their first ever one-on-one match on pay-per-view, their first of many. The next night, on Monday Night Raw, Austin forfeited the Intercontinental Championship to The Rock because he said, quote, I have bigger fish to fry. That being the WWF title. And, you know, I guess they didn't want to beat Austin. So instead, they just had him literally hand the belt over. He handed the belt over to Rocky Maivia, and then he laid him out with a stunner. And then he stole the belt, and the week after on TV, he tossed it off a bridge into a river. Now, if that isn't a burial of the belt, then I don't know what is. He literally buried it at the bottom of the sea. It was also the fourth time that year, in 1997, that Steve Austin lost a championship without actually being beat for that title. That has got to be a record. That has to be. I don't think there's ever been anybody else in that company where in a single calendar year lost that many championships without actually being pinned or submitted or beaten straight up for it. I don't think that's probably happened before or since. He won the tag team titles with Shawn Michaels, and then the titles were vacated when Shawn, had his little cat fight in the bathroom with Bret Hart, and he got sent home. He won the tag team titles with Dude Love after that, and then vacated those after Owen Hart dropped him on his head, and he couldn't defend them. And he vacated the IC title for the same reason, due to injury. And now here, he just hands it over to The Rock. 21 years ago this week, on December 12th, 1999, WWE presented its first Armageddon pay-per-view, notable for a few reasons. We got nudity on a WWE pay-per-view after Miss Kitty won an evening gown swimming pool match to win the women's championship. The women's division was just a dumpster fire at this point. Back then it wasn't so much about having good matches on WWE television with the women. In fact, it wasn't about that at all on WWE television. It was about sex, sex, and more sex. Which is why after the match was over, Miss Kitty decided to flash the world before Sergeant Slaughter quickly wrapped a towel around her naked body and whisked her away. And it was not censored. I don't know what they do on the network now. They probably cut that whole scene out. Or maybe they censor it. But when it aired live, there was no censor. Young me did not forget that. And then Mae Young. I also didn't forget this. Mae Young tried to do the same thing. After they carried her away, Mae Young was there. She was, I guess, the MC of ceremonies. And Mae Young tried to do the same thing. Thank God she was stopped. Sadly, I would be scarred for life the following month at the Royal Rumble when she was not stopped. And all I can say is why? Why did nobody stop her? Why? Why? Chris Jericho beat Chyna to win his first, of nine, right? Intercontinental titles in WWE. He's a 10-time Intercontinental Champion. One of those, though, was the IWGP. So this was his first Intercontinental title win. The Big Show pinned the Big Boss Man in one of the worst WWE title matches I have ever seen. And Triple H beat Vince McMahon in the main event to win a shot at the WWE Championship. Had he lost, his marriage to Stephanie McMahon would have been annulled. After the match, Stephanie embraced Triple H and turned heel, and the McMahon-Helmsley regime was officially formed. 19 years ago this week, on December 9th, 2001, Stone Cold's final night as WWE champion. This was the Vengeance pay-per-view where they crowned a new undisputed champion. The invasion was over. Austin was back to being a babyface as the WWE champion. The Rock was the WCW champion. And they hosted a little mini tournament with Austin defending against Kurt Angle and The Rock defending against Chris Jericho. The winners of those two matches would go on to meet in the main event to crown, I guess, an undisputed WWE champion. Austin pinned Kurt Angle, Jericho pinned The Rock, and Jericho pinned Austin in the main event with an assist from Booker T to become the undisputed champ, something that he does not miss a chance to this very day to let everybody know that he beat Stone Cold and The Rock in the very same night. And at no point after being the undisputed champion was he ever positioned as the top guy in the company. You would think that this guy, my God, he beat Austin and The Rock. He unified the titles. He's got to be the biggest thing in wrestling. Far from it. Didn't help that a couple of months later, Hogan, Hall, and Nash came into the company, and by then he was completely overshadowed. So he may have been the undisputed champion, but he sure didn't feel like it. But, I mean, you just look at the amount of talent and star power on the roster at that time. You had Stone Cold, The Rock, Chris Jericho, Kurt Angle, Undertaker, Kane. Ric Flair had just returned to be the 50-50 owner of the company with Vince McMahon. You had Big Show, Booker T, Rob Van Dam, Chris Benoit. They got Triple H back a month later. Eddie Guerrero, he was back on the indies during this period. He eventually came back to the company in 2002, so they got Eddie Guerrero back. Like I said, we were only a couple of months away from Hulk Hogan and Scott Hall and Kevin Nash coming in. Brock Lesnar debuted a few months later. Shawn Michaels came out of retirement that year in 2002. John Cena, Randy Orton, and Batista, they all made their debuts in 2002, so they were part of the Young Guard coming in. Just an insane amount of talent that they had in that company in 01 into 2002 and what would eventually be the whole SmackDown 6 period of SmackDown, which made SmackDown the A show. Just an incredible amount of talent. Also on this pay-per-view, we had the first match between Matt and Jeff Hardy with Lita as the guest referee. This flopped because nobody wanted to see Matt wrestle his brother. And Undertaker won the hardcore title from RVD. So it makes even more sense why The Undertaker chose to wrestle Ric Flair at WrestleMania 18 when Vince McMahon presented him with the options of who he could work with. The two options that were given to him, and this is The Undertaker telling the story, were Rob Van Dam and Ric Flair. And he didn't even hesitate for a second to say Ric Flair. Now, he probably would have said Flair anyway, because you don't get too many chances to work a WrestleMania match with the guy that you grew up watching. But again, I had forgotten that he and RVD had a match on pay-per-view a few months before. So why the hell would he want to work with him again if he just worked with the guy a few months earlier? Of course, he would want to work with Ric Flair. Triple H was featured on the poster for this pay-per-view because they, even though he never appeared, because they had asked his doctor, the company asked his doctors months earlier, do you think he could be back by December? Do you think we can get him back by the end of the year? And they were told that it was possible. So just picture that meme, right? Vince McMahon, so you're saying it's possible. So they took that to mean, okay, great, we're going to get Triple H back by the end of the year. Unfortunately, he wasn't quite ready to come back yet. He needed another month. So even though he was on the poster for the show, he had absolutely nothing to do with this pay-per-view and was not there. By the time they realized that he wouldn't be ready, you know, these posters and things, they go into development months in advance. They didn't have a chance to change it. 6 years ago this week, on December 11th, 2014, NXT presented its TakeOver Our Evolution show, featuring one of my favorite TakeOver main events ever, with Sami Zayn challenging for and finally winning the big one. He beat Adrian Neville to become the new NXT champion, his first and only title in NXT, and celebrating when the match was over with his best friend who had just debuted in NXT that night, Kevin Owens. He had debuted earlier in the night, breaking his nose in a match against CJ Parker. After the match, Owens attacked his best friend and powerbombed him on the ring apron. Some other notes on this show. Corey Graves announced his retirement from the ring on the kickoff show due to a series of concussions, but also announced that he was starting a brand new career as an announcer, which he started that night. And Finn Balor debuted his new demon persona on this show, wearing the body paint for the very first time in NXT. Obviously, he did the body paint stuff elsewhere and in New Japan, but this was the first time he had debuted the body paint in NXT. He was tagging with Hideo Itami in a win over the Ascension. CJ Parker is now doing big things in New Japan as Juice Robinson. And Itami returned to Japan as Kenta and would probably like to forget that his run as Hideo Itami ever happened. The guy just could not stay healthy. And finally, 3 years ago this week on December 10th, 2017, the reigning Impact World Champion, Rich Swann, was at the time working for WWE and preparing to meet Drew Gulak on Monday Night Raw that week in a number one contenders match for the Cruiserweight title, for a shot at the Cruiserweight title, but he was arrested in Gainesville, Florida, and charged with battery as well as kidnapping and false imprisonment after an incident involving his wife, who wrestles for Impact as Sue Young. They had an argument in their car, and she jumped out of the car while it was still moving. And when Swan, he would not stop, she, I guess, jumped out of the car or got out of the car. A witness told police that he then got out of the car, put her in a headlock, and forced her back inside the car. Prosecutors later dropped all of the charges against Swan due to insufficient evidence, but the damage was done, and he and WWE, after initially being suspended by the company, a few months later in February, they both agreed to mutually part ways. And as I mentioned, Swan has found new success in Impact Wrestling and is currently the Impact World Champion as I am recording this. And that is this week in wrestling history. Got one mailbag question here. I didn't have time to collect too many of them, but I'll do this one and we'll get to more next week. Keep sending in those questions. There is going to be a New Year's Eve stream live on YouTube, a brand new inbox. So if I don't use them on the show here, I might use them there. TheSolemnMonster@gmail.com. This question here comes from Aaron in Brisbane, Australia. Bruce Pritchard, who I met a while back in Brisbane, openly admitted that he would steal storylines from a lower card or mid card wrestler to give to somebody in the upper card if he thought it would be good enough of an idea, during the Q&A portion of the show that he did at the Triffid. What are your thoughts on that? If I were a WWE star trying to come up with ideas, I would be pissed if my storyline or gimmick I came up with was stolen. Do you know if this happens a lot in the wrestling business? All the time. Stuff gets stolen in wrestling all the time. And it doesn't surprise me at all that he would say that. That would appear, I'm guessing, because I looked it up to see what show this would have been that you were at. And I guess it would appear to be from the show he did in March of last year. I see that he was in Brisbane at the Triffid. What is a Triffid? Is what I would like to know. Obviously, it's a venue, but I wonder if it means anything beyond that. Never heard that before. Triffid. I know some WWE stars, or ex-WWE stars, have talked about pitching ideas before that ended up going to other people. If they think it's a good idea, they're more likely to use it with somebody who they are actively pushing or someone that they have, big plans for. So, think about it, right? If you are a guy on the WWE roster, let's just say Drew Gulak. Okay, I'll pick his name. If Drew Gulak comes up with a really clever, creative idea that he's excited about and he pitches it to somebody in upper management and for himself, he wants to use it for himself. And that person says, you know what? That's a pretty good idea. We'll get back to you on that. Or maybe they say, we're not interested, but they actually like the idea. And then 2 weeks later, there's somebody else higher up on the card who's using that idea on TV. That sort of thing, I'm sure, happens way more than we even know about. And yeah, put yourself in the wrestler's position. What must they think? How does that make them feel? But unfortunately, that kind of stuff, it's not an isolated incident. That type of stuff, unfortunately, happens more than it should. And if you're not somebody who is high up on the priority list, but they think the idea is good, then yeah, they're going to give it to somebody else that they like and somebody else that they want to push. Not you. It's not all of a sudden going to change their plans on what to do with you. Kind of an offshoot of this same idea. I was just, the other day I was watching, I saw CM Punk was a guest this past week on Renee Young's new podcast. She has a podcast called Oral Sessions. And Punk was on there and I was watching a video clip on her YouTube channel. And they were both sharing stories about something that's kind of similar to this. Not exactly, but kind of similar. Where they were talking about leaving WWE. And then finding out, and sometimes it could be years later, where they're just out doing something or they're doing some other project. And this person says to them, oh, hey, you know, that role that I had for you, like let's say a TV part or a movie role, you know, that it's too bad that you couldn't do that role that I had for you. And then let's say Punk would be like, well, what are you talking about? Like, what kind of role? I have no idea what you're talking about. And years later here, they would find out that, yeah, when you were in WWE, I had this great part that I had in mind, or I made it just for you. And so I went to the company to just see if, you know, they were interested or if I can get in touch with you and see if you could do it. And either the company ignored them and never got back to them, or the company said, that sounds great, but you don't want him. You want somebody else. And then they would float someone else's name, usually John Cena. But it could be John Cena, it could be Randy Orton, it could be Sheamus or somebody, but they would say, yeah, you don't want this guy. You want to use this guy. And this stuff happens all the time. And Renee Young echoed the same thing. I guess maybe the same thing happened to her. There were certain things that you know people had in mind for her, maybe a hosting gig or something, and the company just wasn't receptive, and so she never even found out about it. So you find out about that years later, and it bothers you. You know, now imagine if there was some kind of big movie role that could have been yours and you come to find out, no, they gave it to John Cena. John Cena is the face of the company. We're going to give it to John. John doesn't do enough. Let's give him more work. It's got to be absolutely infuriating. So anyway, yes, to answer your question, it does happen a lot. It shouldn't, but it does. And it sucks. Thank you guys for all of the PayPal support this week as we head into the holiday season that is very festive, very kind of you. I am happy that you are happy. And the best way you can support this show beyond all of that stuff and using those sponsor links, we talked about Fubo this week, we talked about ExpressVPN. I wouldn't be talking about it if I didn't think they could be of use to a lot of the people listening. But beyond all of that, if you just keep listening and sharing and liking and spreading the word, that is the best thing you can do to support this podcast as we head into what will be our 14th year. 2021 will be 14 years of the Sound Off, and I look forward to spending that and celebrating that with all of you. Follow me on Twitter at Solomonster. Check out the latest installment, video edition of RSPW Rewind. First new one in 3 months. You think it was overdue? I think it was a little overdue. 40 minutes worth of RSPW Rewind. I did push the audio out to the feed, but the video version's just so much more fun. So even if you already listened to it, give it a view, give it a like, and support it on the YouTube channel. I will be back with you next Sunday for episode 683 of The Sound Off. That is TLC Sunday, which means later this week on YouTube, probably going live and doing some TLC predictions, maybe Thursday night, Wednesday night. I'll be back with you live on YouTube for AEW Dynamite, the full recap. And then next Sunday, not only are you going to get one podcast, you're going to get two. Because after 683 that night, I'm going to be going live on YouTube talking TLC and hosting another Wrestle Rumble contest. So we're going to have a lot of fun coming up in this next 7 days or so. And until then, be well. Stay safe. Have yourselves a great week. Again, if you celebrate Hanukkah, night 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 coming up, light a candle for me. Happy Hanukkah. Go play the Adam Sandler song. And I will see you back here next Sunday for more Sound Off. Until then, take care, guys.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
You mean you don't want to hear Josh Matthews doing commentary?
What is Don Callis doing here? He's got Kenny Omega.
You don't want to hear that for 2 hours?
It's a two-hour show.
Can you imagine me doing an entire podcast in that Josh Matthews voice?
Let's read your super chats. Oz and Glorious.
I don't think I would survive. I'd be spitting up blood before I'm even done recording the full show.
I'm very excited.
Sounds like he has a stick up his ass.
The Sala Monster sounds off. Available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesalamonster for sound off extras and more. And follow the Sala Monster on Twitter @SalaMonster.
Sala Monster.
Sala Monster.
Put that cigarette out.
Sala Monster sounds off.